Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, anyone in between, and all those still trying to figure it the fuck out, please sit back, relax, put in your earphones, and buckle your seatbelts. The next 2 hours are guaranteed to not be safe for work. Now welcome to your speakers, smartphones, or laptop, America's sweetheart, Pollo Del Mar, and a San Francisco's blazing beauty, Pearl Tees. It's time for Podomatic's number one ranked LGBT podcast, and 120 minutes of your life you will never get back. Brought to you in conjunction with San Francisco's Left Magazine, it's time for Party Foul Radio with Pollo and Pearl.
Hello again, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Party Foul Radio. I am your co-host, Ms. Pollo Del Mar.
And I'm Pearl Tees.
Pearl, we are one episode away from triple digits.
I know, and one episode into 2018, you guys. Welcome to the new year, hoes.
Well, Pearl has been waiting anxiously. You guys, if you're a regular listener, you know that she's constantly waiting for triple digits.
God, let me just get to 100 and then I could quit.
Well,
don't make any promises that I'll have to hold you to. So I'd be like, well, you made it to 100, bitch. Hasta la vista. As they say in wrestling, good luck with your future endeavors.
Right.
Anyway, it is one episode into the new year. And last week, as you know, we recorded before New Year's, the day after Christmas. But, bitch, I got really lazy with those holiday feelings and the laziness. And I was like, we'll hold out for after the New Year. So you guys got into the New Year, well, with us ringing out the old year. So we were way into it. What did you end up... I know you worked at Asia SF on New Year's Eve.
I did. And it was incredible. I usually don't like to go out during New Year just because of the struggle to get home. So I figured, okay, I'll do the shift, I'll work, and then head home, whatever, call it a night. But I ended up, we did the show, and they set up Asia SF really nice for New Year's. Like, they decorate, there's, like, little party favors and stuff on your table.
Well, all of you ladies looked really gorgeous in your gowns. I did see the photos, you all looked really pretty.
All the girls wear gowns, the girls are nice to each other. It was so nice.
They were nice to each other just for that day.
Just for the day. And then afterwards, a bunch of us just hung out and had a couple drinks at the restaurant bar and hung out while the rest of the people went downstairs to the lounge to party in our club area. But I ended up having a lot more fun than I planned on.
She got boozed up. I just feel it.
Not too much.
It was a pause. She had to try to remember. She's like, what did happen? I don't remember.
Not too much, but it was a good time. And I would totally do it again. Totally do it again. And I would totally recommend someone to come during New Year's.
Well, that is
such
great.
A blast. What did you do?
I did as little as possible on New Year's Eve. I actually went to like a little house party, which... was fun, I guess. It was a little weird because, you know, like when you think about like being at somebody's house for a party or whatever, like part of it is sort of the idea that you're like kind of a lot of people in a smallish space and it sort of gives you like a certain energy and a vibe. No, girl, we were like, he had some people were in his apartment. Some people were in this like little picnic table area at the top. It was in a really cute new building on Market Street right next to the LGBTQ Center, like right next to the San Francisco Gay Lesbian Center. Mm-hmm. And part of us were in this picnicky area on the top of the roof. And then on the roof, there was also there's like a fire pit on one side, which was really nice. And then a lounge area. And so the party was really spread out. So it really legitimately felt like there was only like 6 of us.
Oh, nice.
I mean, even though there was like maybe 20 some people there. But after a while, I was just like, also some gay drama came up. Like one of my friends came and he used to date somebody else. And then like, they didn't want to see each other. And so they left. Was different.
This sounds like a gay party I recently went to.
It doesn't just have to be a gay party because that shit happens all the time at any party. Like somebody's been, oh, I used to fuck with him. Now I don't fuck with him. I used to fuck with her. Now I don't fuck with her.
Yeah, girl, I don't get into that.
Yeah, it was, I don't either. And I ended up leaving that and I went to a sober dance. And it felt like I was in middle school and...
Come on, sober house.
But, you know, honestly... It just, it didn't even, I mean, I celebrated with my friends and we had a nice time. We rang in New Year and then we went home and it was just another day for me. I honestly, the thing that has stood out to me about the week after Christmas all the way up until now, and it kind of plays into what I was talking about earlier in terms of the fact that I just could not kind of get myself motivated to do shit. Like, I could not sit down and edit the podcast or any of that shit. So, is that I've been really lacking some motivation, and girl, I need to get it together. For example, my application for Empress is sitting right in front of us, and I plan to apply this Saturday to run for Empress of San Francisco.
But you know what? If you don't, we won't judge you.
Girl, whatever.
Trust me, we won't.
Trust me. If I didn't, I think a lot of people would judge me, because I got a lot of people talking.
Well, let them bitches judge. Your real friends. Well, your real friends would have your back.
Well, I mean, I do plan to do it. It's just one of those things where, like, sometimes you just have to be like, all right, bitch, sit down and do what's in front of you.
If that's what you want to do.
Right.
Because there's a chance that if you're not motivated, because maybe, what if you don't want to do it?
I don't think it's that I don't want to do it. I just feel like I've been really exhausted lately. Like, the end of the last year, and again, it's the change of the weather has gotten colder. It's still getting colder.
Been cold, yeah.
It gets dark at, like,
early.
It's been
raining.
It's been wet and raining. Like, all of these things really pile up. I am, like, a sunshine hoe. Like, I'm like, give me some sunshine, give me some warm day, give me some pretty weather. And then I'll get up and I'm, like, running around.
Everybody's smiling, sunshine day. Everybody's laughing, sunshine day. Everybody seems so happy today.
Now, I feel like, because I don't like being out after dark really that much. Mm-hmm. Not when it's dark at 5 o'clock, I don't like being out after dark. So I'm like, all right, I have to, like, time things. I was like, all right, better head home. It's 3 o'clock. It'll be almost dark by the time I get there.
Right.
So,
speaking of sunshine, this weekend, I'm actually off to Palm Springs.
Really?
Yeah. A friend of mine from New York called me, and he was like, oh, I found this deal to go. And he lives.
So you're not even going to be at the pageant?
I'm not going to be at the pageant. That's why I couldn't run, remember?
Oh,
and
God.
I was originally going to compete for Star Search, which is the same weekend, and I had to drop
like out of
that.
The two weekends
same
later.
Day.
Star Search is not this weekend.
It is, girl. That's why I had to drop out.
Star Search is not on Sunday.
It is. That's why I had to drop out.
Oh, my God.
I can... Yeah.
I don't think Star Search is this weekend.
Girl, I'm pretty sure it is.
So...
Anyway, so that's partly why I'm not going to be there. Well, that's the reason I'm not going to be there. But it's going to be nice and sunny in Palm Springs.
It will be.
I'm so excited. I've never been there.
It still gets dark at 5 o'clock, but it's at least very warm.
Okay. I'm really...
You've never been to Palm Springs?
I've never been to Palm Springs. And I'm really curious to see if I'm going to run into an ex-San Franciscan, Anya.
Oh, Lord.
Right.
I suppose if you're going to hang around various crack dens and
crystal, oh, my God.
If you're going down there to tour all the local crystal meth labs, you might bump into her.
I have no idea.
God bless them. So Anya is a performer who was really integral in my launch of my show at the cafe a number of years ago, and we got really close. And then, girl,
yeah, but I got
it was right. Nothing that I did. Literally, no. Like, it was, I don't know what happened. Poor child had they moved away. Next thing you know, it was a colossal meltdown, and she, girl, it would have lit up these dark winter nights with the number of bridges that were burning, bitch. It was
right.
Like every bridge. How many bridges did she burn?
All of them.
Every
all
last
of them.
One, all at once.
Right.
And, you know, it's like I live by the philosophy, really, that if you recognize that you have a conflict with a person or a few people, like, maybe you're the problem. Well, when things started, like, going weird with her, I was like, did I do something? And I tried reaching out for her. Next thing I know, everyone was like, nope. She's like, we're all done with her. We're not talking to her.
Right.
Bless their hearts. I hope that they're doing well. I know that, didn't Nikki Ferrari go down and live with them for a while?
Wrong queen, honey. It was Kissy Monet.
Oh, yes, Kissy Monet. Kissy Monet. I can't remember. This was from, like, a few years ago, and legitimately, it was, like, overnight, like, 8 people transitioned. They must have got a special deal at Costco or something.
Kissy didn't transition. Kissy is actually, she left, and I think she now lives in LA and is a flight attendant now.
Really? I thought that Kissy went down there and was, like, transitioning with them.
No.
They were like on a group plan.
From what I heard, Kissy went out there and she couldn't get down with like the drugs and stuff or whatever was going on. This is just what I heard.
Girl, and it's not just what you heard. I saw a Facebook photo and they were like trying to look all cute and there was like a meth pipe in the background. I was like, bitch, at least hide your drug paraphernalia, girl.
It was a meth pipe?
Oh, yeah.
It was
a mess. That was a number of years ago. Poor things.
How disappointing. So, from what whatever.
I really don't judge based on drug activity because I've been there. I've done all of it. Mm-hmm. What it brings up for me is like, ooh, girl, that's just a fucking series of bad life choices you are about to make. That's what it brings for me.
Yeah. Now she doesn't. Now she has like a new performer name and everything.
And Anya?
Yeah. Believe it or not, it's like Ivanka something.
Oh, Lord.
Of course. But I think it was before the whole Trump thing that she had the name. I don't know.
Well, I don't keep up with them. I haven't seen anything about them. And I really do, like, I really liked, they were a couple. I liked them. I mean, yeah. I thought there was some weird dynamics there and I didn't get involved in their personal relationship, but it just got weirder and weirder. And it's one of those scenarios where you're like, what the fuck just happened here?
Right.
So really, that's what it was about. She was very instrumental. I'm grateful for like all of Anya's help when she, whatever. We are spending more time talking about Anya than anybody has in the last 5 years.
Right.
So bless their hearts.
Right.
So I don't know. Maybe they are still down there. I do remember that, I guess the reason I thought about Nikki Ferrari is that she was part of like that same time frame of girls and then she transitioned too. Like I saw her somewhere along in her transition and she was going to become like a female wrestler.
She's a personal trainer now.
So it makes sense. Yeah. I will say it's like, it's very unusual to see somebody who's actively taking steps to become externally feminine and then they're like working out. So she looks more externally masculine than she did even before.
Well, I think that's a misconception because they are changing their outward appearance to look more female, not necessarily feminine. And you can be feminine and built, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's not to say that you can't be a woman who is beautiful and feminine and soft, but still like a hard ass in the gym.
Yes.
But anyway.
So anyway, the last time I saw her, she was definitely built and I saw her at a pro wrestling show. Cause I know that. For a while, she was training to be a wrestler,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, so last I heard, she has, like, a new boo. She got her boobs done.
She had her boobs when I saw her. Yeah, she had boobs when I saw her.
And I think she's going in for another surgery. Who knows?
Okay. Well.
Good luck, Nicole.
Exactly.
What are you doing this weekend?
Well, this weekend.
It's Martin Luther King weekend, you guys. So it's a 3-day weekend. Get it in.
So I am very busy this weekend. On Saturday, the application for Empress is due, so I have to go turn that in. It's just a turn-in, but I have to be all done up and everything.
Good luck.
It's just submitting an application. The week after that, next week after, like...
I mean, good luck on making the right decision, girl.
The week after that becomes a scenario of where I would interview to go in front of a review board for consideration, and then they would approve or deny and move me forward. So that's going to be on Saturday. Then Sunday is the California Gold Pageant, and I'm quite excited.
That's going to be so much fun.
It is. We're going to be having it at El Toro Nightclub in San Francisco. I'm encouraging people who are listening to this in the Bay Area to come out. It's going to be not only just a fun afternoon and evening of drag and entertainment and community building and fundraising, because the whole event is a fundraiser with the winner's charity of choice receiving the benefits and proceeds from the entire event. But we also are going to have some fun judges. We've got 5 celebrity judges who are going to be joining us.
Have you announced it yet?
The judges have not been formally announced, so if you're listening, they'll have just gone up on Facebook probably before you hear this. We will be having from Project Runway and Project Runway All-Stars, Emily Payne is going to be on with us.
All right, Emily Payne.
One of our Party Foul Radio pals, Miss Allison Kenyon from Skin Wars, is going to be...
Come on, Allison. Is going to be in the city.
Yeah, she's going to be back. She judged in 2016 and she had such a good time. That she
such
was like,
a sweetheart. I saw her that year.
She's gagging over excitement for it. Then we will also have with us from Survivor and Survivor All-Stars, Sia's favorite competitor in Survivor history, Ty Trang is going to be on.
All right, Ty.
Oh my God, he's so cute, you guys.
I wish I could go just to say hi to him.
So I'm not remembering if I shared this story recently on the podcast, but Pearl and I went to an event where Ty was a few years ago, and he gave us...
Was it the Project Open Hand at City Hall?
Yeah, it was. It was Project Open Hands event at City Hall. And Ty, in addition to previous to and since competing on Survivor, has always been a beekeeper. So he's a beekeeper, and he cultivates honey. And he brought Pearl and me some, like, homegrown honey, so to speak.
Right.
And A, it was delish. It's super delish. But at the time, I was like, oh my gosh, Ty, did you make this honey yourself? And he was like, no. And I was like, but I thought you were a beekeeper. He was like, I am. The bees made it.
Well, that makes sense.
I mean, it was hilarious, though. He was like, no, I didn't make this. The bees made it. I was like, okay. Anyway, but he's so nervous. He's adorable. And he's like, he and I were texting back and forth today.
One of the sweetest people ever.
Yeah, he and I were texting today, and he's just so nervous. He's like, I don't know what to do. And I was like, well... You know, all you have to do is watch this pageant and give people scores based on what you like and you don't like.
Right.
I mean, it's pretty simple. I'm assuming that there are other people, like, you know.
How do you guys pick your judges?
Emily Pam. Well, I'm still not done with the judges. So,
okay.
We also have with us as our returning, as a returning judge and as the first time as our head judge, basically the Simon Cowell of the group,
uh-huh.
is going to be Jose A. Guzman Colon.
That's right. He's back in town this weekend.
My drag dad flies in on Saturday and is going to be here just in time to judge the pageant. And it's really exciting. I haven't seen him in, like, I don't know, 6 or so months, like that, since he uh-huh. went to Provincetown in upstate New York. So it'll be great to see him again. And he's going to be our head judge, like I said, our Simon Cowell. So basically, in the unlikely event of a tie, which has never happened in 9 years, mm-hmm. He would probably get to cast the deciding vote.
Oh, wow.
And, I mean, I'm sure that will not happen because, like I said...
I don't know. I mean, I love Jose. That's my boo. But I don't know. Like, he actually knows the people out here in San Francisco. You probably want someone else who doesn't know them.
I don't... Well, of the girls who are competing, I think he only knows two of
That's
seven.
Enough, girl.
I guess... If they make it to the top two.
Right.
And then the final judge is going to be Dexter Simmons, who was on season 15 of Project Runway. And before that, he was also on Rock the Style, I think is what it's called. Rock the Style, which was a similar to a Project Runway, but it was produced by Rihanna. And
nice.
What each challenge was... These designers would meet with a different rock star or musician and design an outfit for that person based on the challenge. And then, you know, through that person's decision-making and other people's, like, that the person would each time uh-huh. there would be an elimination and there would be a winner. And Dexter actually provided a winning look in a challenge that was for Carly Rae Jepsen. So maybe she'll call him maybe.
That's cute.
Meanwhile, like, right now, his profile's higher than hers, girl. Right. I mean...
Oh, really?
Well, I mean, just because Carly Rae Jepsen is like, come back, Carly Rae!
I love her.
I do love her. And I really like her one of her more recent songs called Cut to the Feeling. I really like that song. Mm. Anyway, so those are going to be our five judges.
How did you pick them?
Well, the primary thing is every year I want... You know, we are very fortunate because we live in the Bay Area, and a lot of people from San Francisco in the area... get cast on reality TV shows like Project Runway. We've got, mm-hmm. We've got almost every single year, we've got a contestant on Project Runway. In the past, we've had Honey Mahogany judge because she was on Drag Race. We have, I mean, just a variety of people. So I want people who are from reality television in part because of the fact that I want to enrich the experience of people who come out to the pageant because they get to meet these people from reality TV in okay. addition to watching a drag pageant. But we also tend to pick people who have different things that we think that they will be looking for in a contestant. So, for example, Allison Kenyon from Skin Wars is probably going to be looking at, like, paying greater attention to their makeup and sort of, like, the styling aesthetics of, like, how their overall presentation is, because she's used to doing artwork like that, you know what I mean? And then you get somebody like Emily or Dexter, and they're presumably going to be looking at fashion and different elements of that. Mm-hmm. And then Ty, I love Ty on there because he's so nervous because he's like, I don't know what to do. And I was like, yeah, but he has the unique position that he has the ability to watch this pageant just like a spectator. So presumably what wows him or makes him laugh or makes him, you know, him enjoy it is something that he'll probably see without being probably overly critical of things. He just gets to see the entertainment value of it, sort of.
Right.
And I think that that's valuable because there are a lot of times when I think that we watch a pageant or something like that and certain people might be like really glamorous or gorgeous or whatever, but sometimes they're just not that interesting or you just mm-hmm. don't feel them. So I think that he's going to bring that. And then, you know, Jose Puta is Puta has worked with like every drag queen ever. So I think that he just brings a really critical eye. I know that he has helped me sort of hone in on some of the things that I find best about myself, my personality, my drag. And I think that he looks at pageant situations from that perspective. So yeah, that's how we pick the judges. It's going to be super fun. It's only $10 to get in, you guys. And El Toro Nightclub is easily accessible from the 9 or 8 bus lines in San Francisco. Is it a quick walk from the 44 line? Girl, or just take a Lyft or an Uber, like anybody with common sense, bitch.
In San Francisco, everyone just takes a Lyft or an Uber.
Just take a Lyft or an Uber, girl. It starts at 4 o'clock. It will be done by 8 p.m. with a new winner crowned, a new girl with a gift bag full of items, a gorgeous crown, a gift bag of items, including some fabulous Swiss Navy premium personal lubricants.
So what do the girls win?
Is
there a cash prize?
There's no cash prize. Girl, this is for charity. There is no cash prize.
Oh, that's right.
So it's what they win is...
Good luck, lady.
Yeah, exactly. See, there's something to be said, though. You get to win knowing, A, that you won the pageant, and B, that if you actually care about your charity of choice, that they're going to be getting a nice little payout, plus that the whole Ducal Council will be helping them coordinate a fundraiser later in the year for that event as mm-hmm. well. Like, so when Claire won, I think, I don't know, where she got the proceeds from the pageant, and then she raised an additional, like, $1,200 or something for her beneficiary of choice, which was the Castro Country Club.
Cute.
You know, I'm sure that they get other things. They'll get some lube. They'll get... Landa's got some prizes. I don't even know what they are. But that... Because I don't focus that much on that. Getting the judges and helping find contestants, my job. Landa helps putting together the prize package. We divided this all up. So, I also want to give a quick shout-out. If you come and check out El Toro Nightclub this Sunday for the California Gold Pageant, remember, mark your calendars, and Pearl, you should be back for this by January 25th when Wrestling for Charity returns, and I will be back to face my arch nemesis.
Oh, the flower girl.
No, she's gone, bitch. Her manager is still around. I ran the fallen flower Kikio right out of the entire state of California.
That's my name, Kikio.
But the Cold One AC was her manager. And now I'm embroiled in a long-time feud with him. It's been almost a year now that this shit's been going on.
All right.
So, after getting a beatdown at the last event, I'm out to take some revenge on the Cold One AC. And so you guys can come out and check out pro wrestling and your homegirl, Pollo Del Mar.
In the ring, girl.
In the ring, bitch.
That's sickening.
At Wrestling for Charity on Thursday night. January 25th at El Toro Nightclub. It's going to be...
That'll be sickening.
It's going to be a 7 o'clock start time. You guys, Pearl always like, I'm going to come see you, and then never comes and sees anybody.
You know, I should show you a text message. I'm supposed to be at time of the month for Maxine Pat's show, but the thing is, I don't even know if I have that night off yet.
It's on January 25th that night?
Yeah.
Girl.
I know.
I'm sad about that, too, because that's the second fucking... she didn't even ask me to do that show, but I could have weaseled into it, and I had to turn down, like, another gig, because that is the launch of RuPaul's Drag Race All-Stars Season 3
that
same night, which is why I was like, I mean, Maxine, fortunately, my daughter Maxine Pat hosts a show called That Time of Month at Lungamare in Oakland's Jack London Square. Fortunately, 90% of the people who go to it are straight. They probably don't even watch Drag Race, so
right.
It won't be an issue.
That's not true. Drag Race now has so many goddamn... there's so many straight people that watch Drag Race now. They think that's, you know, to them that's...
Yes. Well, It's not quite the same for them as it is for us, because right. it is the gay Olympics, bitch. It is the gay Super Bowl. The finale is right. the gay Super Bowl, honey.
Right.
So we will be checking into that. I'm sure that I'm looking forward to it. And I will be hosting RuPaul's All-Stars Season 3 viewing parties.
Oh.
San Francisco's official RuPaul's Drag Race Season 3 viewing parties each Thursday night at the Lookout. So you guys will be able to catch me there.
All right.
For the run of season 3, and maybe they'll keep me on board to do like the actual Drag Race viewing parties if it's a, you know.
You know what? I have a challenge for you.
What's that, bitch?
So since you're doing these viewing parties, I think you know how they have like their look challenge for each episode?
Yeah.
The next episode, you should dress for the previous.
So you challenge. Pearl's challenging me
To come up with a look
based on the previous week's challenge for each episode of Drag Race Season 3 All-Stars.
And present it at your viewing parties.
I'll take that into consideration. I have to figure out what the fuck their challenges are. Of course, the downside of this for me is that I'll have exactly 1 week to do this. Those hoes get told in advance now what to bring.
Yeah, they do, but the thing is...
It's not nearly as fun. I mean, I know it looks more amazing and more polished than it used to,
yeah.
But there was something to be said for when these girls were like, basically, all right, bitches... You need to fish around and come up with something that is space. Your right. idea of space or your idea of country. Now these girls get told it like months in advance and they have all this shit.
I don't know about
custom-
months, but they get told in advance and it's enough time to come up with something, you know.
Surely for Drag Race All-Stars, you know that they know at least far enough in advance because they want these people to look like All-Stars.
Right.
They don't want them to show
up.
Oh,
yeah. It's All-Stars. It's not just like the regular...
They want them to show up. These are girls who are already in the know.
Right.
They want these people. They're clearly choosing these girls. Some of them for opportunities at redemption. Mm-hmm. Some of them because they know that they've grown a lot. Some of them presumably...
Some of them are just incredible.
Yeah. So, I mean, they get pulled on there. I'm
Do
telling
you have a favorite?
I don't think I have a favorite, but I already feel like before they've ever aired an episode that I think that this is going to be built for Trixie Mattel the same way I felt that season two was built for Alaska.
I've heard a couple rumors, and I haven't really heard anything about Trixie Mattel, but I think I know one of the people that make the final episode.
I will be excited. Because I am already aware of who it is that's going to be their surprise return, like 10th.
You know who it is?
Yeah, of course I know who it is.
So I don't know who it is. I'm hoping it's Trinity. And if it's not Trinity, I don't know. But that's who I'm hoping for.
It's not Trinity, girl.
It's not. That's so disappointing.
You're looking at way too recent. Bitch is a blast from the motherfucking past, hunty.
All right.
So... It's going to be...
If it was Angina, that's another one I would live for. It's her birthday. It was either yesterday or today. So, speaking of which, happy birthday, Angina.
Did I ever tell you about the time that she stayed here and she was mortified because I have a huge douche hose in my bathroom?
Yes, you did.
Oh, my God. She's like, oh, my God, you have a huge douche. I was like, I sure do, bitch. Use it to massage your back and get the fuck up out of there. I'm starving. Let's go to breakfast. I was like, come on now. Let's do this shit.
I cannot.
Come on. Fuck, I'm going to die of starvation while you're bitching about the do shows.
Shit.
Literally. So.
I can't.
So, yeah. All right, you guys, why don't we take a quick break? And when we come back, we have a great pre-recorded interview with Damien from Mean Girls. That's right, Danny Francesi is going to be on with us. He has a new series on Here Network, which is available also on Amazon Prime. It is called Falling for Angels. It stars Alec Mappa, singer Steve Grand, Danny Francesi, and many more of our LGBTQ favorites. It's set in Los Angeles, and we have a fantastic, fantastic talk about this. Plus, if you don't remember Mean Girls and you need bitch slapped, if that's the case.
Right.
Danny was also a regular on the show Looking on HBO, and we didn't talk about it, but I had a great opportunity to work with him on the set of Looking, the movie, when they did the finale movie.
Uh-huh.
And girl,
they did a movie?
Yeah, they did a finale movie.
Because, that's hilarious.
So they did a little finale movie, and like Sister Roma and BB Sweetbriar and I were in that in the finale movie. And
I'm sure a ton of queens
Cleve Jones. There was a lot of us in it. But this is where it paid off. Because, like, at first, they divided us all up.
Mm-hmm.
And they put me in this group. And they said, oh, you can go sit down in the back. We'll bring you out when we're going to fill this in or whatever. Then, like, 5 minutes later, somebody comes in. He's like, which one of you is Pollo? Oh, and I was like, I am. And they're like, oh, come with me. And turns out that Danny had called for me. Called for me. And then they placed me, like, there was the scene right when we were at the end up. We were filming at the end up here in San Francisco. And they placed us right by the door. And as they were getting everybody in place, you know, the camera crew is like, everybody in your places or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And Danny comes over to me and he whispers, you stand right here. I'm going to walk directly to you. And then I'm going to want you to hug me. I want you to hug every single person behind me in the cast and greet them. Because that way they will not be able to cut you out of this scene at all.
I heard that.
And I was like, look at you just being the sweetest thing ever. So, sure enough, girl. They come in and they greet me and there I am in all my glory.
Uh-huh.
It was lovely.
I didn't even know it was a movie.
Yeah. Looking had a really avid following, but it did not seem to catch on in a general sense. And actually, in this interview that we'll bring you back to in just a few minutes, Danny and I talk about that, but they ended the series, and it was a series, you know, it was like a soap opera type of thing. So they didn't want to just leave people hanging about what the hell happens with these stories.
Right.
So they filmed a sort of finale movie, which allowed people to buy, now you can buy a whole looking two-season box set of DVDs and see it from the beginning to the way it ends at the very end. So, and if you buy that, look for me, I'm only in the one episode. but you can see...
That sounds like Shangela season two.
Girl, it's the truth, bitch. It's like, but you can see plenty of your Bay Area favorites. Honey Mahogany is in one episode where they focus really, like, closely on her. She's, like, singing and they give her some great FaceTime. Sister Rome is in a couple episodes. Roxy Cotton Candy's in an episode. Uh-huh. Anyway, look for it. We will be back with more Party Foul Radio, including our interview with Danny Francese, right after this. Every episode of Party Foul Radio is brought to you in conjunction with San Francisco's Left Magazine, Northern California's most beautiful LGBTQ news, entertainment, and lifestyles publication, is available online at liveleft.com, liveleft.com, or pick your copy up in San Francisco's Castro District today. Daddy's Barbershop at 4102 19th Street in the Castro was voted San Francisco's favorite barbershop in the 2017 Bestie Awards. And they now have a new location coming soon to Palm Springs. Stop by and see Arlen, Jesse, and the men and women of Daddy's Barbershop to find out why they are San Francisco's favorite barbershop and a proud sponsor of Party Foul Radio.
Hey, what's up, y'all? This is Kelly Clarkson. I'm hanging out with Party Foul Radio.
Welcome back to Party Foul Radio. I am your co-host, Poyo Del Mar, and I'm pleased to introduce our celebrity guest for this episode. Danny Francese made his big star turn as Damien in Mean Girls. You may remember Damien because he was too gay to function. He was the best friend of Janice Ian. And as the outsiders in the school, they tried to convince Katie Herring to disrupt the plastics clique led by Regina George. If you have not seen Mean Girls, I don't know why I'm explaining this. If you have not seen Mean Girls, just as soon as this podcast is over, go watch it, first of all. And second of all, shame on you for not knowing Mean Girls. But after Mean Girls, Danny has had a successful career with film and television roles, including a stint on HBO series Looking, which followed the lives of LGBTQ members here in San Francisco, where I had an opportunity, as you heard just a few minutes ago, to work with him on the finale show. But he has an upcoming series on Here Network, which is a subscription LGBTQ series, and it'll also be found on Amazon Prime, as he tells us. It is called Falling for Angels, and it's set in Los Angeles. Please welcome at this time Mr. Danny Francese. Yeah, you're like, now that I'm an engaged woman, I just can't have all these men's in my life.
It's true, right? I think that was a respectful thing to do. I think that, like, you know, probably other people who have been engaged have done the same thing. I don't know. I imagine it's what you do.
Well, I'm guessing that probably more people who get engaged should do that, and the marriages would work out longer, probably.
Yeah, you're probably right. I just started getting, like, random texts, like, you know, like, especially, like, with my nude scene, I'm looking, like, people are just, like, texting me, and I'm like, okay, this is not going to work out.
So, really, like, I mean, I'm curious how that, first of all, I wanted to ask you about that, because it's not often we get to see anybody outside of basically the societal body norms do a nude scene, and I was wondering how that was for you.
You know, anytime I even, like, take my shirt off, like, it's kind of weird. I think what was cool about it was it made sense from an acting standpoint of, you know, the vulnerability of Eddie in that moment where he thinks he's going to lose Augustine. And I think it was his most naked emotionally, and I think that that's why that scene made sense to me.
Yeah,
well, as far as, like, the sex scenes go, I mean, I never had an opportunity to do something like that, and anytime I have an opportunity to sexualize a bigger gay man, I'll take it, because, and that goes into what, you know, looking for, falling for angels, because it's like, it's just something that things are erotic because we're close to them and we see them, and often they're even more erotic when they're taboo and we don't get to see them. So I think that I've spent a good portion of my life as a queer person trying to find anything that resembled me on screen. And so since I can't really find it, I'll just be it.
Yeah, I'm the exact opposite. I spend the most time trying to avoid anything like myself on the screen, especially when it's naked. I'm like, oh, girl, put some clothes on.
Well, I don't know necessarily, like, I'm not even talking about naked. I'm just saying, like, you know, I'm a big guy, but, you know, I have, like, a pear shape and, like, a different shape, you know, and I'm tall, I'm not short, and I'm also, you know, there's things about me that I've never seen quite my combination. I have in real life, but I've never seen it really on screen as much. So I'm proud to show my curves or whatever. It might be a little weird because maybe it might give somebody else a little sort of identity. Representation matters, and, I mean, I've noticed that because when I was Damien in Mean Girls, it was the first time that I read a character that wasn't made fun of, you know, or, like, his weight isn't even talked about in the movie. And still, I have reviewers that brought up my weight, you know, her fat friend or whatever. I still get that. But so we're a society where people body shame and people point out differences constantly. So the more things can be seen, the more they become normal and palatable.
Our last episode of the podcast was a recap of all the interviews that we did, like favorite pieces of my interviews from the last year or whatever. And one of them was with Ross Matthews. And he said that, you know, when he was growing up, there was absolutely no one like him on TV. And because there was no representation, when he had the opportunity to fill that void, basically, that he really did jump at it, not only because it was great for his career, but just because there's some kid somewhere who can look at him and be like, okay, I can't relate to these Abercrombie and Fitch models or whatever, but that's somebody that I can relate to.
Yeah, I think it was interesting to me that a lot of the guys that I had met when I was single and dating, that especially the ones who have fetishized bigger men, had said to me that they mentioned some movie, I still don't know which one it is, where James Gandolfini was in it that had a nude scene. And they were like, that was the first time that I was like, look at that big man or something. And I was like, huh. You know, and then it kind of really, it made sense to me that the more that I knew going into looking, the impact that I had with Damien. And I was like, well, here's an opportunity to do this on an adult level. Not only am I sexualized and not just like, a castrated comic relief, but here there's an opportunity for me to be pursued by one of the attractive male leads, you know? Like, that doesn't even happen, like, in stories, you know? There might be, like, a bear storyline on the side or something like that, but this is an opportunity for me to, like, sexualize. But actually, the representation impact, I feel like, is more playing an HIV-positive person. I mean, that's something that we didn't get to see a lot on TV at that time. I mean, my character was the first HIV-positive character in a scripted series in 6 years.
In six? Wow.
Yeah, and GLAAD actually approached me and asked me to present the media playbook on HIV and AIDS to MSNBC because they realized that the character before me was Gloria Rubin on ER, and with Variety, we sat down and did a roundtable with Neil Baer, the creator of ER, correlation between the lack of representation and the rise in infections.
Yeah, I mean, part of me, I'm wondering how that works. I guess it's just because of the fact that it's not being discussed as much.
Well, I think there is a lot of theories and a lot of things that like can be pinpointed. The first one is 9/11. So celebrities wore red ribbons to the Oscars every year until 9/11, and then they wore like a different color ribbon to represent that, and then it was kind of like ribbons were out after that. And so it didn't become like popular in Hollywood. And then the LGBTQ movement, you know, we have moved on to things. At the time, marriage equality became a very important topic for us, and so did trans acceptance and just, you know, non-gender conforming acceptance is something that it's very hot and sexy to talk about right now. But it just kind of put, and since people were living a longer and healthier life with HIV, it kind of pushed the topic to the back burner. We've been trying, especially in recent times, to bring the conversation back up because it needs to be a conversation about where we are in today's age of prevention and treatment. Because when we were seeing those stories growing up, the Ryan White story, you know, the special episode of Designing Women, etc., we were seeing stories that made the disease human, and we were getting to know, quote unquote, people who were dealing with HIV. So now, without it being in the narrative anywhere, there was nobody we knew, and if it was someone we knew, they were healthy. So it didn't seem like a hot-button topic.
Right. I do wonder if one of the things that was great about your portrayal of an HIV-positive person on Looking is that it did kind of, I mean, it reveals the state of infections today, that people who are positive can lead fulfilling, healthy lives.
Yeah, we were the first show to speak about PrEP.
Yeah, well, I definitely think that more places need to talk about that across the board. I mean, that's something that...
Well, 32% of our general practitioners don't even know what it is, which is crazy to me.
It's especially crazy. I live, you know, of course, in a bubble here in San Francisco, so it's very much a topic of conversation. And any sexually active gay man over the age of, you know, whatever, who basically any sexually active gay man or bisexual man or what have you, is either educated on or exploring the option of PrEP, because, which I don't understand anybody who would not, because despite the fact that there are other STIs that it can't come back.
That we were shown in San Francisco that was discussing it. However, like, one of the things that I've committed myself to is to try to figure out ways to reaffirm Hollywood's commitment to eradicating the disease and to talking about it, which is interesting that I play HIV positive in Fallen Angels.
You do as well, again.
Yeah. Yeah, because I had I jumped at that opportunity. It's one of the main reasons why I took the role, even though it's not a main part of the story. We do discuss PrEP in Fallen for Angels, and we do discuss that I am HIV positive and my partner is not. But I just felt like it was a great opportunity for me to say, hey, not only will I play an HIV positive character and be a person who's negative, but I'll play it twice. And it'd be two different stories and two different ways that people are living, you know? And I think that to me is, you know, showing a true commitment to telling more stories.
So tell me a little bit more about the concept behind and premise for Falling for Angels.
So Falling for Angels is like a limited series that all takes place in Los Angeles. And Los Angeles, as we know it, is not in actuality a city as much as it is a gathering of all these little villages.
Right.
And so each episode takes place in a different village in Los Angeles, Bel Air, Boyle Heights, K-Town, and mine is Silver Lake. And so in the segment, and you know, without giving too much away, all of the characters are connected in some way in the end. And my character is partnered for many, many years, married, and they're just toying with the idea, him and his partner, of introducing a third into the relationship. And they decide to try to explore that one night at the Thomas Finland house, and things don't go as they planned.
Yeah, I think that anytime people talk about opening up their relationship, I think that it almost never goes as planned, ultimately. But
well, it's kind of funny because I feel like since we are now taking the stigma of sexual deviancy out of the LGBTQ community, gay or straight or whatever, there is going to be a new form of, you know, mutation of something that's underground and sexy because it's taboo. It has to always exist.
Yeah, I definitely think that one of the things that we are facing as now marriage equality has moved forward, and it was an internal struggle, I think, within the community even, that many people, for example, of a certain age did not want marriage equality per se. Well, I mean, they wanted marriage equality, but they didn't want the right to marry, because that was something that I believe for many people, when you grow up being told you can't do something, after a while you're like, well, okay, that I don't even really want to do that. Like,
yeah, I kind of feel that way about the wedding cake issue. It's like, well, if you don't want to make a cake for me, I don't want your fucking cake. Like,
I do feel that way 100%. I mean, I get why the people are pressing the issue, but I'm just like, okay, you don't want to make my cake? I wouldn't want my fucking wedding cake made by people who hated me anyway. Go fuck yourself and your cake. Like, moving right along.
I almost feel like a resolution for that issue would be that people who don't want to make cakes for gays should have a sign on the front of their door that says no gays allowed. And I'd be happy with that. Because then everyone could just know they're a bigot, and it's not like some couple has to go in there while they're planning and travel to the bakery and come in there and then be treated a certain way. Like, put it on the outside. Let everyone know you're an asshole from the beginning. Then you guys want to eat your freaking cake, and I bet you a lot of other people would feel the same way. But if you want to have the right to not serve people because of your religion, then put it on your door. Say, God says no gays. Do whatever you want. But let us know so we don't have to walk in. That's what I want. I want to take a humiliation out, like, especially since I'm planning a wedding right now. You know how hard it is to, like, look at venues and look at cakes and hors d'oeuvres and everything else. Please put it on your front door, and please put it on your website. And by law, they should have to say this establishment reserves the right not to serve gay people due to our religious beliefs, and that should be the law. They can do whatever they want, but they should have to put it on the on their thing so everyone else can know they're an asshole too.
I think some places are saying that they want to do that, and a lot of people are really appalled by that, because that's really taking a step back to where it was, like, no coloreds allowed, that sign.
Yeah, exactly. So if they want to go there, they should be allowed to do that, because then I feel like, trust me, that's history. Nowadays in social media time, are you kidding me? Like, I don't think that the civil rights movement would have taken as long as we had social media. Because we could see no colors allowed on the diner, and then everyone could, like tweet the diner and tell them they're an asshole.
Well,
you know, whereas, like,
right.
a diner in Tennessee might not have gotten that national attention. But today in day, put that on the wall and see how people treat you, see how people ignore you, how they look at you, how your customers, straight and gay, fall off because you're an asshole.
Unfortunately, as much as I think there's some truth to that, I also think that they would probably get a huge influx of people. I mean, come on now, the no gay cake place or whatever made like $100,000 on a GoFundMe or some shit. They made more money off of...
I can't be the only one that's never eaten Chick-fil-A again. But I never had a bite in that poison gay-hating chicken ever again. So it's kind of like, to me, at least I know. And there's people that eat at Chick-fil-A all the time. I give people side-eye all the time when they bring it up. You know, but at least I know.
I definitely think there's something to be said with the idea that I would make certainly a big stink of somebody telling me that they didn't want to make my gay wedding cake, but I would blast their asses on social media. Whether or not I actually think that I would take somebody to court is a different situation. Seriously, how important is the fucking cake to you? That's kind of what I'm asking. And, like, I mean, if there are people who want to allow their business practices to be dictated by hatred or Islamophobia, homophobia, transphobia, phobias galore, then let that be their business practice. But as a person who does not espouse to any of those, if I know about it, I certainly would not go to a bakery that I found out, you know, does any of those practices.
Yeah, I would love to boycott somebody. Believe me, it'll help shorten my decision making. I have a lot to think about.
Exactly. Oh, I'm sure. So, a friend of mine who manages a Starbucks, his name is Andres Campos, he was like, they got engaged at a Starbucks.
Yes.
How did you decide to get engaged at your favorite Starbucks?
Well, I met him at, I engaged him in the exact spot I met him at.
Aww.
Yeah, so we met there. And then he's such a hard person to surprise and to, you know, and to trick. And so I brought him there that day. I said, look, we're going to take a photo for People magazine because because I knew that we were going to film it, and he works in fashion as a stylist. So I wanted to make sure that he was dressed, at least in a way that he felt comfortable having his photo taken, or I might not have got married. and then we went there, and I had camera people waiting and everything, so it was really cute.
Oh, my God. I am going to go and stalk every... I'm going to be in line at every coffee shop in all of San Francisco tomorrow. I'm just...
Yeah, it was actually kind of crazy. Joseph grew up Mormon, so he didn't really... Like, growing up, he never was taught that celebrity was something to look up to. So he didn't... He never was really interested in too many films and things like that. He didn't see Wizard of Oz when I met him. So he had never saw Mean Girls. He didn't know who I was. He saw... One of my movies that didn't know was me, but he didn't. But his friend was like, "Oh my gosh! Like, I want to meet that guy and take his picture." So he was like, "I'll talk to him. I don't care." And he came up to me and asked me if I wouldn't mind taking a picture. And I said, "Only if you're in it." And then after he took the picture, I was like, "Let me have that picture." And he's like, "Well, give me your number and I'll give it to you." And I'm like, "Do you want my number?" And he was like, "Well, do you want the photo?" And I said, "Only if you want my number. Otherwise, I don't want the photo."
Wow, you.
Kind of the rest of his history.
You work a mean negotiation.
I went into Starbucks for Grande Americano, but I left with a Venti Puerto Rican.
Oh, God, I love a Venti Puerto Rican, honey.
Me too, honey.
I didn't even know there were Puerto Rican Mormons. That sounds so culture clash.
Yeah, well, you know, they do a lot of outreach, you know? So they went to, they go to Puerto Rico and everything.
I thought you meant Puerto Ricans, because I've had a few reach out to me. Hey, and I enjoyed every second.
There's a huge Puerto Rican contingency in the Mormon community.
I had no idea.
Maybe neither did I, but, you know, it's kind of interesting because he's no longer with the church, but he has, like, all these incredible values instilled inside of him from growing up. And then, you know, on top of that, you know, he's like a Puerto Rican ex-hip-hop dancer from Manhattan with swagger.
That sounds like... fucking dream come true.
A unicorn, right?
Yeah.
I was like, I better put a ring on this right now.
Yeah, put a ring on that unicorn horn.
Yeah, he's amazing. He's just such an incredible heart. And, you know, like I said, he's got all the swagger and flavor that I know from being from Brooklyn. So it feels like home.
That is adorable. I am going to be on the lookout for that tomorrow at 18 different Starbucks in the San Francisco Bay Area. So I'm hoping that if there's a Mormon, Puerto Rican with great values and una big pinga, please check all the Starbucks. I will be there all day, all of them. I was really impressed by the cast that they pulled together for your new series on here, because they've got Alec Mappa, they've got you, they've got Steve Grand. I mean, it's a pretty stellar cast, and I didn't even know Steve Grand acted.
Yeah, I mean, it's really cool. I'm happy to be a part of the story. Tell things about Los Angeles. You know, I love where I live, and so many movies film here, but we don't often get the opportunity to see things that take place in this intimate of a version of Los Angeles.
Right, or even gay Los Angeles outside of, like, West Hollywood. People, when they think of L.A. and gay, they think of West Hollywood, which that's, like, people thinking gay in San Francisco and only thinking of the Castro. Because I would venture to say you got the best deal, because Silver Lake's my favorite part of gay L.A.
Yeah, me too. I mean, that's why I live over there. So I'm actually, like, you know, portraying my actual neighborhood.
Silver Lake's got, it doesn't have, well, it started to feel, has it felt more gentrified to you? Because it feels more gentrified to me when I visit.
A little bit, but not really. It's still definitely, I mean, anything east of La Brea still has a lot of flavor.
Yeah, I can't, like, West Hollywood has so little appeal to me, aside from my friends who do the drag shows and stuff there. All the girls from Drag Race, of course, do all the drag shows up and down throughout West Hollywood, and I visit them when I'm there. But it, in a lot of ways, I feel like as our culture has, and by that I mean our gay culture, has reached this tipping point towards acceptance, we are losing so much of the flavor and identity that really made us so much fun for me to be part of.
Well, that's what's really great about this series. I think it does that very well, and make sure to be a part of it.
So, I wanted to ask you, a while back I read this article that said that you were bullied by your castmates in Mean Girls. And I know that's old news, but I have never actually had the opportunity to actually talk to you about it.
It wasn't in Mean Girls. It was in Bully, my first movie, Bully.
Oh, so you got bullied and bullied. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what happened? I bet it said like Mean Girls star was bullied on the set of a film.
Oh, right. Not on that set though.
Okay, well that's good.
Yeah, it's Larry Clark's movie Bully. To just address your question about that film, I found it really hard entering, coming from a place of musical theater where I started to feel comfortable about sort of tiptoeing out of the closet, and then getting my first film and be treated so horribly by my co-star about being gay and about being queer, and it just shaped a lot of the way I let a lot of people treat me about being gay and being queer in Hollywood for many years, and a lot of the stuff that, you know, I know regrets or whatever on your journey, but had I had been met with open arms on my first movie, I probably would have done things a lot differently early on.
It's very interesting that you say that, because even when you were playing Damien in Mean Girls, at the time, you weren't open about your sexuality, I guess.
Right.
Because later on, they made a really big deal out of it when you eventually came out quite publicly.
Right.
Was that influenced by that experience?
Being closeted at that time?
Well,
yeah,
I'm saying, like, was your experience being bullied for being queer... Like,
yeah, I mean, it was only like 3 or 4 years after that, you know, so that was the time that I felt like, well, I've seen firsthand how even so-called progressive people aren't comfortable with this and how I've been treated because of it. So I was very, you know, my second film was a football movie and they were afraid that I was too gay to play the part or too soft is the word that they use. So I had to act like real tough and act a certain way, and that got me my second movie. So I was nervous, definitely, about it. You know, but I also would never turn down the opportunity to work with such an amazing cast on such an amazing script. And it was my first studio film, so I was like, it was like God drives my career. And I was like, well, you know, this is one that I'm being told is right. So I was able to go into it with confidence I hadn't previously had. Plus, I feel like a lot of the gay roles that I was reading at that time in cinema were all exploitative and... You know, all we had was Queer Eye for the Straight Guy and Will and Grace, and that kind of wasn't even really there yet. I think Queer Eye came out the same year that Mean Girls did, so it was just, like, starting to sort of go that way. And I remember how shocking it was that they used the word queer in a title for a TV show, and now it's, like, whatever.
I remember thinking how strange it was when it became, like, a big phenomenon, or it was made a big deal of, that you came out, because one would have... From a kind of an outsider's perspective, the thought that your sort of big break, the movie that got you a lot of attention, being Mean Girls, that the character was gay, that you presumably collected a fan base and an audience base that supported and appreciated you as that character. So one would have thought perhaps that they would have been equally supportive if you had been open about your private life.
For like 2 years after Mean Girls, I was celibate. I refused to even date because I was afraid that I would end up like... or go to a gay club, and I was afraid that I would, like, run into, like, a casting assistant, or, and I would come into some auditions, and, like, the few times I did go out, or did, you know, people knew about, and I'd be in an audition, and the person, like, doing the filming, my audition, would be, like, someone that I knew, I would, like, have a heart attack, my ears would burn, and, like, my heart would beat, like, you know, and I had situations where, like, I went in for Ugly Betty, and I really wanted to play this part of Ugly Betty's boyfriend, who was an Italian guy that worked in the sub shop, you know? And I was like, this is so right for me. Like, this would be a great thing. And Ugly Betty's boyfriend, I could be Ugly Betty's boyfriend. And the casting director was like, no, I have something else for you. And then called me about Michael Urie's boyfriend. And I got so mad I turned the audition down. I mean, I might have booked that. But, like, I was just like, I can't be, you know, it was the fact that I wasn't allowed to play straight if people thought I was gay. I didn't like that feeling. You know, I had no problem if people didn't know. Like, when I went in for Stranger Grave or Stateside or any of my other movies, and people didn't know about me, then I would get the part. But if they knew or they thought they knew, they wouldn't even let me audition sometimes. And I was meeting a gay glass ceiling. So, like, this one movie I went out for called Sherry Baby, co-starred Maggie Gyllenhaal and one of my best friends, Bridget Barkin. And Bridget and I had done 3 movies and a play together. We lived together in L.A. We were really close. and it was to play her husband, which was a blue-collar, doughy lug of a guy. That's how it was written. And that's exactly my type of guy I play. And the casting director, who was a lesbian, wouldn't let me audition. She said, "We love Daniel, we think he's a great actor, but we need a man's man." And she wouldn't let me audition. I wasn't even allowed to apply.
By a lesbian, and nonetheless.
What's that?
By a lesbian, nonetheless.
Exactly. Actually, I felt like the most pushback I ever got in Hollywood was from Jake. They kind of were like sniffing me out, like, "I know you, forget you, you're going here instead." And I didn't like it. I didn't like the way it felt, so I had to live my life a certain way in hopes that that would dictate my art in a certain way. But, you know, authenticity is what matters, and I will play straight again, and I will play gay again. And I think at the place that we're in right now in entertainment, it doesn't matter as much anymore, because now gay people have arcs and have problems, and they're discussed in cinema when they were just fodder for laughter or, you know, plot development. I mean, I remember watching Rounders, where everyone's, like Vin Diesel, all those people in that movie, they're all like traitors, you know? And it's such a cool movie, and no character's gay. But then they go to a restaurant, and then there's gay people talking, and they're like, "Can you guys, please, you should all be on an island somewhere." And the gay guy turns around and says, "I got news for you, honey, there is one, and you're on it," and they're in Manhattan, you know? And I was like, that's the gay character. There's no gay character that's in there doing the trading, and I'm sure there is in real life, right?
Of course.
So the stories weren't being told that way. They were the joke, or they were the trailer moment, and they were being exploited. And so I didn't want to just play these bit parts. I'm not a bit actor. I felt like I had more to contribute. You know, even though it was a small part, Steven Spielberg cast me as a soldier in War of the Worlds, like, other people saw things in me that I was able to do when they didn't know. But would I get that role today? Maybe not. It just depends on the casting director and how people thought and how they felt about me, what preconceived notions they have about me. You know, and I think that, you know, as we know, gender and masculinity, femininity, all of that is all fluid. So if it's fluid, you know, we could mold it just like we can. That's one thing that actors are good at.
Right. We see it all the time. Like, one of the things that I will say that very much frustrates me on occasion is when some straight actor, some heterosexual actor or actress plays a role that's gay or lesbian, and the community, like, races to laud them, and they win GLAAD Media Awards and all this stuff, and I'm like, we should really be celebrating our own who are sacrificing opportunities to play other characters by being outspoken about who they are on a personal level, and thusly, even if it's very slowly, moving our community forward. So,
well, I agree. And then it's like, you look at some of the roles that, you know, African-American people win Oscars for, you know, Halle Berry wins for playing a prostitute. Like, there's like, you know, there's other, they're still fighting their own stigma. We're still going to be fighting that same thing too. I mean, I would have so rather seen a trans person win an Oscar than Jared Leto, you know?
Right.
And it's like, it just takes time, I guess. And the more we're visible and the more we're creating projects and, you know, and that's why I could turn down something that I don't like, that I think is exploitative, that pays me a lot of money, that's for a studio. And then I could do something like Fallen for Angels, which is more independent and more personal. And it's the reason that I chose to do something like that. You know, I was like, I had an opportunity to tell another HIV positive story. I'm not going to wait around for somebody to write one. You know, this is a great one, and it doesn't matter if it's a smaller production, but we need to have these stories being told. And they'll end up in the eyes they're supposed to be seen by.
Yeah, and I think the fantastic thing about any kind of art or film or project like this, and I think about this all the time, even as a writer, I have no idea when I'm actually sitting down to write a piece of, you know, whatever, an article, an interview, who it's going to see, you know, and who is going to find it, and who is going to find that message at just the time that they need that message. And I really think that that's the beautiful thing about art in general. It touches people when it's supposed to and how it's supposed to, through no contributions of our own, once we kind of put it into the world.
Yeah, we'll see, you know, what comes of this kind of an attitude. You know, I mean, I may be unemployed for a very long time, but, you know, I feel like at this point, I have been chosen by somebody, by something, by God, by whoever, to play these roles that are underrepresented people. And partially, you know, I'm getting known for all the things that people have held me back or made fun of me for my entire life. And now I'm being celebrated for those things. So I would just continue on this road and choose things that matter to me, or challenging to me. And, you know, now I have a clothing line, and I do stand up. I'm setting my stand up toward the end of the month. And I'm doing other things that I'm able to use my talents for that generate revenue. That way I don't have to sit around and wait for any opportunity to be on screen, and I could actually choose the things and the projects that feed me as an artist.
Well, have you ever considered doing, when I had Dustin Lance Black on here, he said, if you don't see your story in the media, and if you don't see your life or person reflected in media or in films or television, start writing your story. So have you ever considered?
I have written stories, and I have developed stories, and I've pitched many, many, many things. I haven't had anything bought yet because a lot of the pushback and a lot of the feedback I get is that, you know, gay TV doesn't work. I get looking thrown back up at my example of a show that got shut down pretty much by the gay community. And, you know, I want to continue to tell gay stories. Last year, I pitched a gay Christmas movie. I pitched a gay political comedy show. I pitched a gay guy and girl best friend show. You know, and I'm still pitching a lot of those things. Gay horror movie. These are all things that I've been pitching because I want to continue to tell stories. But I'm going to continue pitching and continue creating and continue writing, even if it's only for me, because I have to express myself that way. And one day someone will say, yes, I want to make your stuff, and maybe we're just not ready for that yet. But who knows? There's a lot of things around the corner that might be coming, and maybe we'll get like a gay Get Out or like a new version of Will and Grace or something like that that'll come around the corner that someone will be like, hey, I want to hear this story. Until then, I could just keep creating and writing and trying.
You mentioned just now in passing that people perceive Looking to have been a production that was shut down by the gay community. And I was wondering what specifically you mean by that.
Because the people who complained about Looking were the gay people. And most of them were gay people that didn't watch it. And I was guilty of it myself, which is why I agree. When Looking came out, I had no plans on watching it. And someone said to me, are you going to watch Looking? And I said, no. And they were like, why? And I'm like, because there aren't guys like me on shows like that. And then my friend was like, well, why don't you be the guy on the show? And I'm like, it doesn't work like that. And then I looked at the casting director, and I realized she's the woman who discovered me, Tripoli. And I wrote her a letter, and I said, hey, maybe you need a bear someday. And she's like, actually, there is one, and next season, you never know. And she brought me up, and they were like, yeah. And so that's how Looking happened. But so maybe there is more room out there for people that are different, you know? But I understand how they felt. And at the time, people just were like, I'm not represented here. I'm not seen here. I need to be seen here. And, you know, I don't know who wasn't represented. We had lesbian recurring character, two black recurring characters, an Asian recurring character, all kinds of gay people, you know, hairy and shaven and big and HIV positive. And, you know, we had, it was so diverse. I mean, in the movie, you know, even one of the guest stars is Indian. Like, we had almost every nationality, like, every kind of race. We they were supposed to hire one trans teen for season two, and they loved them all, so they hired every single one. We were employing, like, 18 trans teens. And I just think it was so beautifully diverse. And then there was, like, you know, like, characters. I mean, Carmen is a brilliant casting director. She cast Stranger Things. She cast Bully. She cast, like, amazing projects. And she even had, you know, like, a trans actor playing a chef, and nobody said anything. You know, like, it wasn't, like, mentioned. It wasn't a thing. You know, it was just peppered with all different kinds of people the way San Francisco is. And so I don't know who was exactly complaining about it, but there was tons of hate tweets and hate mail and bitchy comments on magazine blogs and everything else. Until finally it just seemed like it wasn't wanted there. And meanwhile, our fan base was so hardcore into us. They were throwing Looking parties and watching us and everything else. You know, but I guess we weren't getting a lot of the numbers because of the backlash against the gay community or their unwillingness to accept it.
My issue with the show was that I thought the storylines developed at a really slow pace. I was like, good God, let's just speed this up. But
I agree with you with that. I agree with you with that. When you watch American Horror Story and so much happens in a half hour, that, like, you're like, what? It's like 10 different levels away from where it was the episode before. And then in this day and age, you watch something like Looking where it unfolds at like a really slow breath of a pace. Because sometimes life unfolds that way. And it's only a 27-minute show. And the first season was only 6 episodes. And the second season was only 10 episodes. We didn't have a lot of time. You know, we didn't have a lot of time to tell the story the way we wanted to tell the story. A 27-minute show is not a lot of time.
Yeah.
But I think for it being a 27-minute show, the whole first season's only 6 hours, and the second season's 8 hours. And for that amount of time, I think he told a lot of great stories and, you know, brought up a lot of emotional things. And, you know, even the sexy moments, it wasn't like a lingering exploitative camera. It was like just quick flashes, enough to get you excited and realize what happened, and then we're on to the next part of the story. We're moving faster than you think. I think if we were an hour show and had 22 episodes, like Queer as Folk, we would have had a lot more story in there. But being a half-hour show, it was all the time that the gays were allowed to have the 27-minute show in the corner of Sunday night against the Oscars and the Tonys and everything else. You know, and like the late night on HBO, for that amount of time, and the time slot we got and the time we had, I think we did a lot. And I think that it just needed people to support it, and it would have grown, and it would have gotten longer and bigger. And instead, they were like, we don't need it. It was the only gay game in town, and it was taken down. So I think that's really affected not only our show, but a lot of future gay programming, because this is a what-have-you-done-for-me-lately town. And if that show was successful, we'd have lots of different gay shows popping up. But because that show was cut off too soon, it only influenced things to be cut off. Representation does matter. Seeing yourself on screen in some way, shape, or form, it translates to confidence and validity.
Right.
And that is why I will never shy away again from telling queer stories, even if I tell too many. And that's why I took the opportunity of For Falling for Angels to tell another gay story, and especially another HIV-positive story, and just to continue to represent an underserved and underrepresented group of people.
So when and how can people find your new project? It's Buying for Angels.
It is on the Falling Fear Network, where it's your TV, and I do believe it will also be featured on Amazon.
The fact that they are now partnered with Amazon is going to make it so much more accessible for people. So the project is going to see even more people.
I think so too.
That was Danny Francesi. He is on the new Here Network series, Falling for Angels. It also stars Alec Mappa, formerly of Ugly Betty, as well as Steve Grand. You may know him as a country pop crossover artist and an openly gay actor now, apparently. It is going to be available on Amazon as well as the Here Network. Look it up online. That's Falling for Angels. You are listening to Party Foul Radio. I am Poyet Almar, and we will be back with more right after this. Australia's Guide to Gay.com is the best way to stay up to date on all the happenings in queer things down under. That's Guide to Gay.com. Guide to Gay.com is a proud media sponsor of Party Foul Radio.
And you're listening to Party Foul Radio.
And we're back with more Party Foul Radio. I am Poyo Dalmar, your co-host and producer. Remember, follow the podcast at Party Foul Radio. You can find us at Party Foul Radio on both Facebook and Twitter. Now it's time to take you to our next celebrity guest. He was on season 15 of Project Runway. He's from Oakland, California, and he is a designer who has styled such people as Carly Rae Jepsen, and many, many more. Please welcome Mr. Dexter Simmons, everyone.
Hello.
Dexter.
Hey, good morning.
Good morning. So are you ready?
I guess it's afternoon for most people. I'm like, this is morning to me.
Well, it's only 11 o'clock. It is morning.
Yeah, I know. My other friends are the 6 a.m., 7 a.m., I'm running kind of people. So they're like, oh, you're getting up at 11? I'm like, oh, okay.
that is not me at all. So I don't... I do not understand people who, like, wake up, especially people who wake up to, let's say, run. That makes no sense to me. I'm like, why are you running? Is something on fire? Because that is the only reason to run. Is there a shooting? That is also a reason to run.
I'm down with exercise, but, like, I can't... There's a certain period. Also, I sew at night. Like, I have insomnia. Like, just naturally, I've always had it. So I sit up and sew really late at night.
Yeah, well, I do drag. So I've been in nightclubs until late at night. And then I'm a night person. So I stay up and I write and work on things in the night. I have panic attacks in the night because I read too many headline news items that are horrible and tell me that the sky is falling and the world is crumbling around me, and that gives me panic in the night, and then no sleep sometimes. So
all I have is art to deal with it this year. Last year was hard too, but I feel like it'll be I don't know. I'm feeling really good. I have some stuff coming up in February, so I'm kind of excited to get out of here again.
So you are based in Oakland, but you've spent a lot of time in Los Angeles and other places showing off your clothing lines. And tell me a little bit about what the last few years of experience has been like for you since you were on Project Runway specifically.
It's really interesting because I've done two of these kind of reality shows, and like they've had such different responses to like what I ended up doing afterwards. But the big thing and the most important thing is like Fashion Week, like that you just get into Fashion Week every season just to kind of like show people, you know, like the full version of what's going on in your mind, not just like here's my jacket I made and here are these pants that I like tinkered away on and made. It's like this is where my mind is at. If you really love fashion, you can get behind it.
You mentioned that you've had a different response for each of the reality shows you've done. By the way, it's an interesting fact for you that it seems to take you exactly 5 episodes to hit your stride on these shows because you won the 5th challenge in both reality shows.
Yeah, that's like an up and down thing because it also, if you notice, I get tired of dealing with cameras in my face at the exact same period of time, and then I always do something kind of crazy and go home because I'm just kind of like, I don't really care if I stay because I'm so tired. And it's kind of a weird thing that happens. You have to be there, but like, you know, you go to bed at like midnight, 1 o'clock, and then you get up at 4 a.m. every morning to start shooting. And then as the weeks go on and the months go on that you've been there, at some point those hours just kind of like mess with you. And you can't drink, you can't call your friends, you can't get on the internet. Those seem like small things until you're stuck in a room for 3 months. So I usually do pretty well around the same period of time, and then I usually go home at the exact same time on every show.
On Project Runway, for example, what is a filming cycle for one episode? I know on Drag Race, it's like 2 days is one episode, but what is the duration of time that goes into one episode of Project Runway?
I think the actual time we have to sew really is one day. But it's not really one day, just because you have to drive to places. So you have to, like, drive through New York traffic to get to Mood, and then you have to talk a lot when you get there, and then they let you work. And so, like, those hours in between kind of, like, filter into the time that you have in your day. So, I don't know, it totally depends on what day, because they switch different days. But generally, you're up at, like, I don't know, like, 4 or 5 in the morning, and you generally are out until 11, 12 o'clock. Sometimes you get out at 10, but it still takes you, like, there's no way to get to bed before midnight.
And how many days of filming do we see during the course of one episode? Is it like 4 days makes one episode or 3 days?
No, it's really 2 days. And most of the other filming is like the second day. It's just like the, you know, like the eliminations and like talking to the judges and stuff. Like that's basically the majority of the second day. And then in the morning, they give you like an hour to finish your projects or something like that. So you basically get most of the other day, the day before, and then a little bit of time in the morning.
Yeah, no, it's no wonder that people who are super fast in terms of, like, their actual production, like, I remember, like, Keeney was on, and they always commented on how quickly he could sew everything. I'm like, that makes a huge difference, presumably.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think I can sew fast, but it's something about being in that environment kind of, like, makes you, you ever go to those wig shops or, like, those really, really amazing, like, beauty supply stores, and you look around and you're just overwhelmed by all the stuff.
Right, exactly.
All the little trinkets and things. That's, like, what it's like being there. It's just, like, there's a lot of stuff happening. There's people running around behind the scenes. They pull people out for interviews at different times of the day. So it's, like, you never really get comfortable dining. You're always kind of in and out.
Yeah, I think that's really, I mean, that is tends to be key on any reality show. Like, nobody's allowed to settle in at all. There's no, and, of course, then they expect you to still produce your best work. And I'm like, honey, you've set them up to produce their worst work, not their best.
Yeah, it's definitely, like, a fun experience, and it's pushed me. So, like, now if someone says, hey, we sew in this dress, like, sometimes I take a week before to, like, finish a project. But I can, like, sew a dress in, like, I don't know, a couple hours if I really wanted to.
So you mentioned that you had a different response. You were on Rock the Style first, and then you were on Project Runway, and each of them gave you a different audience response and response in your career, presumably is what you mean. And I was wondering if you could kind of describe the difference between the two responses.
The first show, Styles Rock, and it was just like a different kind of show because I was dealing directly with celebrities, which is, you know, more so what I wanted to go into is like designing for bands and making things that are seemingly a little bit more unwearable for like tours and stuff like that. So because I've gotten some emails from Project Runway before, and even though I think the show is amazing, and it, like, for what it is, it's super cool, it's just, like, I'm a little bit more off the grid, and, like, I like the underground stuff, so I kind of knew it wasn't going to be my favorite place to be, but then, you know, getting a call from Rihanna is, like, that's just, like, okay, I'm going, they're like, oh, yeah, it's Rihanna and Pharrell, and this supermodel Erin Watson, I'm like, well, that's my speed, those people, like, kind of, you know, they're rule breakers. So it seemed like it would be a more fun show. And the response from that show was just different because it was like, it's kind of sad in our industry, but people don't really see the value of your work until they see it on celebrities or on TV. Because I've been in the Bay Area doing this kind of stuff for like a good amount of time. And I had like a good following, but there's a large perspective of people that only really care what they see once a celebrity has endorsed it. And so people watching me work every day with celebrities like Kylie Minogue and like Rihanna and, you know, sometimes there's a Kardashian in there, and it's just like there's people kind of could vibe on the fact that this is what I should be doing for a living. And Project Runway is different. It's like introducing these like seemingly, I'm like doing air quotes, but like no name designers, and then like sort of starting them from the ground, and then they're not really like working with celebrities; they're just designing for challenges every week. And so it's different. You know, you still see me as a struggling artist in a Project Runway kind of setting. And so I think that gives fan base, you know, like 80% of the fan base is amazing and they're super sweet. And then there's another percentage of them that are just like very, they're not buying it. You know, they're like, these aren't designers. These people aren't really making things. And so I think I hit the negative stride of the internet more when I did Project Runway, and that kind of freaked me out because I didn't have any negative things happen with the other show. It was just pretty smooth. Project Runway has a bigger fan base and they're very opinionated and some of them are very angry. So, you know, I definitely think I had a better, for my career, I think the first show was more me. Just, you know, just to be honest, I think Project Runway is amazing, and it's amazing for the right kind of designer.
There's a few, so many different things that are coming to me from what you just said. First of all, definitely as a longtime viewer of Project Runway, there are certain types of designers whose looks and aesthetics are always going to flourish on that show because they tend to, with the exception of individual challenges here and there, really focus on stuff that has just a generally more mainstream vibe to it. Even if it's unwearable, you can tell where that person's going to go, and you know that it's like they're gunning for a line of clothing at Kmart or something. You know what I mean? Like it's very mainstream.
Very directly with JCPenney's, and it was kind of one of those things I realized. Like when I was in fashion school, I realized that a lot of the people that graduated from my school just kind of would work for the Gap or they'd work at Nordstrom, and that just freaked me out because those are amazing places. But on the same note, like that's not the direction I'm trying to go in my career. So it's kind of scary when you're in a front row to head in a certain direction. You kind of have to curve left on your own, which is what I was trying to do when I was there. It's just kind of like just keeps making stuff like I didn't care that there were judges, that there were people there, because there's so many opinions. Because one week Tim Gunn is like, I really love this. And then you go 3 feet and Zach Posen's like, this is a piece of shit. And so sometimes Tim will set you up because he's really, like, he doesn't mean to, but he'll set you up for these moments where he's, like, pumping you up on something, you turn a corner and everyone hates it. And so, like, for me, I just had to do what I wanted to do. Because if one person's telling me one thing that I'm supposed to be listening to and the judges are telling me another thing, there's only one person that I need to be listening to at that moment, you know, unless I'm praying. Like, I just need to, like, focus and do my own thing. So I honestly just made what I wanted to make and, like, kind of did my own thing. And if it worked, it worked. And if it didn't, it didn't.
We've seen so many people on those shows, though, that have listened to people's strong suggestions and you should do this and it needs to be more this way or that way. And then they end up creating some item of clothing or a look or something that doesn't even reflect who they are and they don't even feel comfortable with it. And then they end up going home on that challenge because, and they realize way too late, like, well, if I'm on here and I'm going to end up going home because of somebody else's opinions, I need to make sure that I at least like what I'm doing. I feel like it reflects who I am every moment that I'm here. Otherwise, I'm going to get sent home on some shit that isn't even really my aesthetic. And then I'm going to feel bitter.
Yeah, it's hard because it's like, it's Zach Posen and then it's Heidi Klum and then it's Nina Garcia. And like, you know, out of the three, it's pretty obvious that Nina Garcia is the most qualified to like, talk about fashion. Cause she's been running Marie Claire, and she works just directly in it. You know, she's not one specific kind of fashion. She's not just sexy dresses or suits. She's kind of, like, all these different things. So, like, honestly, she was probably my biggest barometer on, like, which direction to go. You know, whether she liked it or not, I didn't mind because I respected her opinion.
I don't know. I just don't feel like it it pushes the envelope the way that even meeting you in person, like, your personal aesthetic pushes the envelope. You, like, you walk down the street and it's clear that you stand out from other people around you based on the visioning you have for either yourself as a person and, like, representing your own clothing or representing your idea of fashion in a way that most people don't. Most people are like, this looks comfortable. And this is me. Like, this is comfortable. This, like, these pants don't make me feel fat. Whatever.
I don't know. I'm, like, a nerdy kid. Like, I used to read a lot of X-Men when I was younger. And just a general comic kind of sci-fi and horror has always been, like, my sort of movie genre. And it kind of is, like, my vibe, too, just for fashion. Like, you know, I went to a lot of, like, punk and metal shows when I was younger just because I didn't really fit in the gay clubs. I mean, I was 16, let's be honest. We all snuck into a club or two. But I just didn't really fit in there. And, like, I wasn't trying to, like, be extra buff and run around and, like, you know, it just, that scene was not for me. I didn't want that. I know who I am, and that's not me. So I usually just went to punk shows and like, metal shows. And so a lot of my fashion and a lot of my personal style just kind of stemmed around all those little things that I did when I was younger to, like, avoid, like, mainstream cultures of different kinds.
Very interesting. I know that you also, like, when did you start collecting skulls? That's creepy, by the way. A little bit creepy.
Well, when I was younger, I studied herpetology. That's, like, the study of reptiles and whatnot. I was a big science nerd, so I used to, you know, just, like, work with, like, curing skulls back then just because I had access to, like, these beetles that clean skulls. So I would, like, collect them and, like, make art out of them.
Yeah, I remember on your one of your videos, you were like, sometimes my friends send me skulls and they're a little fleshy. I'm like, who sends another person a fleshy skull? That takes us very special type of
really, really awesome friend.
God, I mean, at least like put in an anthill or something. Let it like get all eaten up so that it's not like fleshy.
I mean, I feel bad for my parents. I used to have these like garbage cans full of these different solutions to, like, eat away at them in their backyard, and so like. I think they were a little worried about the future of where I was going with my life.
Of all things that you could have chosen, fashion is probably, like, better than the, like, I'm going to become a serial killer and, like, dissolve bodies in the backyard route.
Oh, man. Yeah, I definitely, I don't know, I've always been kind of fashion, though. Like, when I went to the punk shows, I sewed my friend's patches on, and, like, you know, when I used to duck out to those raves late night in the Bay Area, like, down around 6 and... just that area. I think it's like Jack London Square. There used to be like a barrage of underground raves around there, and I would go to them, but I would like make costumes for all my friends. Really, really awful costumes. Really disgusting furry things that I'm quite embarrassed about at this point in my life, but I don't know. You know, it's like how Madonna feels about her first album. Not that I'm doing any equating before anyone gets the wrong idea, but you know that feeling your early work is kind of almost like a little embarrassing to you, but you kind of have to embrace it.
Right. Again, you're talking to a drag performer and people constantly are tagging me in some photo from like a Facebook memory. Oh, look at us 9 years ago together. And I'm like, if that photo never saw the light of day again, I would be only overjoyed. But it's like, it's who I was. And it reminds you of how far you've come and what you've accomplished, right?
No, it's true. And you need that. I needed that. I kept a couple photos with me on Project Runway and this note from my mom, this long, drawn-out note from my mom that I refused to read on camera, and I refused. I told her before I left I wasn't going to call her, and she knew what it was. Like, I told her that on the show before. It's, like, sort of the curse. It's the curse of the reality show. The person who calls home always ends up embarrassing themselves on TV. And so, I don't know. My mom knows I love her. We're, like, we're besties. Like, I don't need to call her to discuss it. She knows that I'm basically in some sort of fashion war at the moment, and, like, my emotions being thrown off was not part of the deal.
I always wonder, no matter what kind of a reality television show it is, the human nature response is, if I was in this situation, I would do X, Y, Z. But the reality is that until you're in that kind of environment and under all those different pressures, and they set it up in a certain way to evoke emotions from you by making you tired and making you hungry and making you overwhelmed and exhausted. So until you're under all those stressors, you have no idea what the hell you would do. And I will admit, like, I am one of the worst in terms of viewing, especially with Drag Race. I'm like, oh, I would have bought, but you have no idea. Like, until you're in that environment, and I'm sure, I actually would not shy away from having called my mom, though, because my mom is fucking hilarious. And I'm sure that they would have gotten some really, really cute video of that if it had been my situation.
Yeah, I know. That's what everybody said to me. But I know personally, especially from being on another reality show, that everyone who calls their mom breaks down for 3 hours. And it's not just when the camera's there. It's like not being able, having your phone taken away, having the internet taken away, having your computer taken away, having any contact to the outside world taken away, and then you're moved to a home and you're moved around by security guards. And like someone follows you everywhere you go. And so they know where you are at all times. You have a microphone on. You have a microphone next to your bed in the first show that I was on. So it's got you so like tight that the idea of someone coming and loosening that feeling up for a minute makes you break down. One girl on my first show broke down for like 3 hours. She was crying for like 3 hours. They had to like calm her down. She's just like, I just missed my mom. And I was like, ooh, that's not going to be me. I'm just going to not.
I'm imagining that scene from Airplane where everybody's lining up to slap her and like shake her. You know the scene from Airplane?
Yeah, she had a hard time, this poor girl. She had a very, very hard time. She cried like the entire season, and I think it was her biggest regret.
Lord, get a grip, bitch.
Yeah, you know, we tried. We really tried to help her out. But some people, I don't know, that pressure, I'm telling you, like, everyone's like, oh my God, I would have made this if I was you. And I was like, listen, I had 30 minutes to sketch. I only slept for 2.5 hours the night before that. 2.5 hours. And they're telling me to sketch. And then finally I get to this mood place, and it's like 5 floors. I'm just like, I'm in platforms, and I'm looking at the stairs, and I'm looking around. I'm just like, okay, I'm just going to go to the bottom stairs. I'm going to find something down there because I'm clearly not going to the top floor.
So you mentioned being mentored and working with a lot of celebrities while you were on Rihanna's show in particular. And I was wondering if you've maintained some of those working relationships.
Yes and no. It's kind of interesting. These shows, they set you up to make all these fans believe that you're having these close, you know, entwined moments with these judges. And in moments, I had mine on my first show more so, but they keep you very separate. And they don't really want you around them, and they don't give you an opportunity to actually network, and it's very frowned down upon on those shows. So it's kind of interesting. It's like if someone was going to have to find you, they'd have to find you later because they pretty much keep you talking to the people that are there. So it's interesting because they bring you there to kind of further your career and meet all these people, but they don't actually let you really get too close to too many of them.
Right. I mean, it takes – I would imagine that it takes considerable legwork after the fact. I mean, that's when it comes time to like – do you remember, I mean, hello, look, I practically stalked you, and it's, I'm not trying to get anything from you except for you to judge my drag pageant, you know what I mean? It's like, if it was something like really professional, trust, I would be like, remember me, just like, very definitely that annoying girl who's constantly pestering for something.
You know, honestly, I'm really one of those weird people who just kind of goes about my life and does my art, and like, I'm not really too caught up on who ends up wearing it because I kind of know it'll just happen, like, naturally. I know it's a weird way to go because we're in California and a lot of people are like, network push, call people, like, you know, like, go to their club, like, show up at this place, and I'm just not that person, like, and in my heart, I know I'm not that person, so I kind of just have to, like, move at my own pace. My biggest, most important thing is my art and performance art and making people look awesome and, like, taking creative direction jobs and like whatever, like that stuff's more important to me. I'd rather do underground fashion for the rest of my life, be totally happy making money, like getting by and doing my thing, because I get to create and I get to do my own thing. If someone else wants to call me and do something, sometimes it's cool, but a lot of times bigger people have called me and they've been a nightmare, and I'm really not trying to be involved in a nightmare situation, you know, like Project Runway was enough, and that was a life furthering thing, but that was a bit of a nightmare at times, you know, just with the sleep and being tired. It's cool to watch it later. I'm sure people at home are like, oh my God, that's so much fun. And I'm just like, it's finals week for 3 months. Oh my God. This is the kind of shit that people who design have nightmares about when you go to school and you're spending all your money in school. And like, they have you working and working and working and sewing. And you're like, I don't know how I'm going to finish all this stuff for finals. I have 6 classes. But just imagine all your finals weeks pushed into a 3 month period. It didn't hit me until I got there. And then I was like, oh crap, this is going to be hard. And then when I went in for the second one, I already knew that it was going to be hard, and my only goal was to avoid drama. Like, avoid people I don't like, which clearly doesn't work. But that was my big thing, because I was like, because of what I look like, I already know people are going to think that I'm bitchy, and I'm actually just pretty chill, and I'm pretty nice for the most part. So I didn't want them to have a lot of stuff to edit of me being, because when I'm honest. If I don't like you, I'll just tell you, like, hey, I don't like you, like, it's fine. It's not like we have to have issues about it, but I really don't want to be around you. And so my brutal honesty tends to get me in trouble, and it definitely caught up with me on Project Runway.
I will admit, when we first met, when we were first introduced by our friend Robbie, I looked at you, gave you, like, the once over. It was like, okay, this person probably have to be dealt with pretty gently because you look like you have opinions. Like, you look like you have opinions. You also look like you do not shy away from giving those opinions, which I actually really like, but it can, since I'm also that person, I recognize right away, like, okay, this could be a relationship that has to be handled gently because otherwise both of us are going to offer something the other one doesn't want and it's just going to become too much. But in an environment like a television environment, I just know like sheer exhaustion and pressure would make the walls, like my judgment and when I give an offer my opinion about things would come down with the less sleep I got. And before very long, I'd just be like, okay, this is how it is, bitch. This is just what's going on. You need to know. So maybe you should go over there and I'll just stay over here.
Well, I think they wanted more drama out of me than I was really willing to give. And like, if you did watch the season, like through most of the season, I pretty much got along with everybody. Everybody, we were all laughing. We're all having a good time. And then there was people that I didn't like. But just to be perfectly honest, the people that I didn't like, I told them. I said, listen, I didn't come here for a bunch of shit. So we clearly don't get along. I really, really don't like the way that you're playing this game. I don't like the way you insult this person. I don't like the way that you're running around, stirring up all this drama. So I'm going to need you to stay out of my face. I'm going to need you to stay over there, and I will respect you. And if you need my help, I will help you. If you need to borrow something, you can borrow it. That's totally fine. Just stay out of my way, and I won't get in your way. Like, mad respect to you. Let's just keep this cute. So I said that. I did that. And I did that a couple times. And then I went on to full avoid. Like, don't speak to this person. Just, like, avoid, 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 avoid. It's going to be okay. We only have, like, so many more episodes left. I'm getting tired. I'm probably going to go home soon. Let's just keep it out of the way. But people are tricky, and they somehow magically end up at your table all the time, or magically end up in a group with you. So they know what they're doing.
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, all of that stuff. Anybody who thinks the pairings on reality TV shows are random or no, ma'am, Pam, I'm sorry. They've got some people in a room like, oh, we've picked up feedback that this person and this person hate each other. They are the perfect team for this challenge. So, yeah, they're fully
aware.
Yeah,
they really wanted it.
Oh, they want it. Of course they want it. That's the term good TV, darling. That's the term good TV.
Yeah, I mean, we always have this one girl or guy who comes into our green screens and basically spends half the time in their green screen trying to stir us up and tell us about what everyone else was saying and what's going on. And, like, I noticed this about this person, and I'm like, I was like, you do realize that I'm from California and San Francisco. People do this shit all day, what you're doing, this messiness. I was like, I'm not doing it.
That's exactly it, and I believe that once people become aware, if listeners become more aware that there are people in our lives, like, we think that this is something relegated to reality television, because they do. They have wranglers on reality television and producers who are there exclusively to tell you bullshit and try to create drama because they want to capture it. And unfortunately, you're 100% correct. There are actual people in our daily lives, no matter whether we're working in an office building in Des Moines, Iowa, or fashion in San Francisco, or drag in New York City, or wherever. There are people whose sole goal in life, honestly, is to create drama. If they get something out of it in some capacity, they feel important because they have some tidbit of information, or they feel influential because they can elicit a response. And I think the more successful people in life are the ones who recognize that right away and just say, you know what, that person having an opinion or doing what they're doing isn't the problem. You running around telling everybody about it, you're the problem. You got to go.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I definitely... So I get there, and they put me in a group with this person who I don't get along with. If you know, you know. If you don't, you don't. I'm not really trying to, like, make it a thing. But I did my best to get through the situation, and then they put me in this really shitty situation where they're like, who do you want to go home? The person who's been really nice to you the entire competition, who's done better and who has the more interesting aesthetic, or the person who's been really shitty to you the entire competition, who's talked shit about everyone behind their backs, and who came there and specifically said, I'm here to cause as much drama as I can to stay as long as I can. So I picked the other person, the person who I thought was like just in the moment, like a better human being, you know, who was in the moment, how they dealt with stress. I was like, I appreciate that. I love your work. I love your aesthetic. And the other person I didn't really feel the same way about in the moment. And so I let them know that after I was forced to against my will, even though I told them almost 6 or 7 times that it's not my job to judge people. I did that. And then the internet came for me.
That is one of the things that consistently amazes me on audience response to reality shows, because when I'm watching, I don't know what other people take away from situations like that. But when I'm a viewer and I see that somebody is forced to choose who should go home, I always think, like, okay, if I were in that situation and I could do something that would eliminate the person who's drama, or if I could eliminate the person who is causing me issues, and there's valid reasons for it, I'm fucking going to pick that person. Like, you're forced to make a decision one way or another. So why do people take it, like, so personally? I'm like, girl, you're not even involved. You're just watching this shit somewhere in a living room. So sit down and have a seat.
Yeah, it's funny how holy people expect me to be. I'm like, I'm just you. I breathe, I drink, I take shits in the afternoon. Like, what the fuck? Like, of course, on occasion, I'm going to have to just be honest. Like, I don't want this to be around anymore. Like, one of my other really good friends in the competition had been insulted, and he was, like, really upset about it. He's like, I can't believe he just runs around and says these things. Someone's got to do something. And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking around, and I'm thinking about that moment, and I'm like, I don't want to deal with him every day. If he could just go right now. You know, and I was like, I'm not going to send myself home. I'm just not that kind of person. And, like, they want, like, some holy person who's going to send themselves home and sacrifice themselves for the greater good. I'm like, what greater good? We're in a competition for a lot of money. It's not like we're trying to make sure that everyone's okay. Like, you told us we're supposed to be competing. You've been pumping us up to get mad at each other every day, even though all of us just want to get along. And now I'm just like, okay, I'm going to have to go ahead and say, yeah, if you're going to force me and tell me if I don't say this and I'm going to go home, then yeah, this is what it is.
And it seems fair enough to me. And I also don't think, maybe this reflects on me poorly, but I also don't think if you're in a competition and you recognize that somebody's a really, really strong competitor, and you say that, like, you know what, I feel like my biggest challenger here, or the person who's, like, the biggest obstacle for me to win is this individual, and if I have an opportunity for that person to go home, then I think it would clear the path for me to do better, so send them home. Go. You gotta go.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely could have gone in that direction, because I know that the other person on that stage, who's not necessarily the nicest, would have definitely gone with me on sending the person home who was on the stage that was my good friend. And then she would have been out of my way, you know, because she would be my biggest competition. But on the same note, I would never do some shit like that.
Absolutely.
I couldn't. Like, it's not me.
That's what people sign up for, really. When people say that, like, this is what I signed up for, I mean, it is what you signed up for. You know you're going to be put in uncomfortable situations. You know that you're going to be forced to ultimately compete against people that you quite often do like and you do respect and you would presumably like to spend more time with outside of that environment. It just makes for conflicts that aren't real world situations, because most of us find opportunities in our real life to sidestep situations like that. You're not forced to make a decision. You're not forced to throw your friend under the bus. You're not even forced to throw your enemy under the bus or the person that you can't deal with under the bus. It's just like, I just walk away from this in that type of environment.
Yeah, that's kind of how I felt.
You know, in that environment, you're not allowed to. So my drag mother, Landa Lake, is Native American. She was born on a Chickasaw reservation, and she was excited by your designs on Project Runway because you always try, or quite often try, to incorporate some of your own Native American history into your designs. And I was wondering if you could tell me more about that.
Yeah, it's not too much to say about it, but I'm just a very mixed background person, like, racially, and so I kind of draw inspiration from different aspects of, like, where I'm from. But without it being, I don't know how to explain it, I get really annoyed when it's just like, this is where I'm from, so I'm only doing these perfect tribal dresses. I'm like, no, I mean, fashion is fashion, but I basically just, my mom is, like, one of my biggest inspirations, and she's, you know, I mean, that's her culture, and that's my culture, and so I definitely love the idea of different tribes around the world, and just the fact that, like, tribe culture is just so interesting to me, especially, like, the tribes in, like, Alaska and, like, even, like, Australia. Like, there's just so many different versions of tribes in the world. It's kind of, like, nice to immerse myself into other versions of it, but I generally stick with, you know, the things that my mom taught me, and, like, the things that meant a lot to her, and, like, the colors that she liked, and the textiles that I found in a lot of her old sewing baskets, and, like, just very, all of her Native American stuff is in this giant basket, and so some of the specific textures, I always, when I see them again, I repeat them, I grab them, just because it's just, like, natural now.
I think that's great. I really, like, I'm the exact opposite. As a person, I have very limited ties to any particular culture other than, say, generalized American white trash culture, because, you know, that's where I grew up. But, like, the fashion icons of that are less influential in the greater scheme of things. And there's less of an opportunity, if I were a designer, I think, to incorporate elements of that than things like tribal cultures or specific ethnic cultures even have really specific things that if a person is designing for the wide populace that they could incorporate here and there so there were elements visible in their overall aesthetic that reflect where they come from. That was just sort of a statement.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree with you. And I always, it's so funny because I always think about doing bigger collections with tribe stuff. But the problem is that, like, if I do a huge collection of tribe stuff and I put it into stores, then it's like, it's a hard thing because only so many people can wear some of the items. And so I've always used them as more of, like, my performance art, explaining who I am and using it, you know, in runway fashion that people probably won't end up wearing unless it's in a music video. But it's kind of hard to mass market your culture, and I'm not really about that. So I just generally try to keep it as my major runway pieces or things that are just, I'm trying to explain where I'm coming from. I use it in those instances more than not.
The problem also becomes that when you try to mass market something that is culturally referential, it opens the door for significant opportunities for people who probably should not necessarily be wearing that or have no cultural ties to it to...
That's exactly what I mean.
Yeah, I mean, and that kind of idea of appropriation is such a dual-edged sword because, you know, as a person, again, who has no specific ties to any kind of culture, there are things that I just find really beautiful and maybe I would want to wear it or maybe I would want to do it. But I'm also sensitive enough to the issues surrounding that to think to myself, like, I'm probably not the person that this was intended for. I'm probably not the best representation of the individual that this designer would like to be seen, have this seen on.
Yeah.
The problem with fashion is that fashion is usually designed to appeal to the masses. And then we kind of almost lure people into this trap where they're like, well, this is beautiful, and it's colorful, and it's this and that, and I just like it. And then people are like, but that's reflective of this culture or that tribe, and you're not, and therefore, I think it opens the door for people to end up being viewed as insensitive when they're just trying to be supportive of a person's artwork that they like or just embrace a look, and they're like, they don't really even think about what it means on a greater cultural level to other people.
Yeah, welcome to the equation wrapped in a conundrum that we call 2017. It's like a very weird time period because there's not a lot of shit you can get away with. And so I just generally try not to do that kind of stuff for the most part, you know? I mean, I'm not really going to speak on it too much, but I'm not fully offended, and I'm kind of on the middle of the fence about how to do these kinds of things. It's just, it's all about a taste level, and the moment someone pushes the taste level over the line too much, you get this gross feeling, like, oh, that makes me uncomfortable. And it's like, if people would use their natural barometers for knowing how far to take things, I think that we wouldn't really be in such a weird situation. But there's always that asshole who takes it too far and ruins it for everyone. And then you have very pissed off tribes going, what the hell? Like, you know, like, maybe don't wear ceremonial headdresses to Coachella. That's kind of important to us, you know? Or it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like cutting up an American flag to make an outfit for someone. You know, it's like, it's pretty rude. You can do what you want, but it's a slippery slope. So I don't know. I just speak to my fashions the best that I can. I'm from a performance artist background, so I like to let people know about it. And I also like to create tribes that don't exist. And that's been my biggest thing throughout fashion is I'll take my knowledge of different tribes and then my love for sci-fi and like weird movies and I don't know, like Fern Gully even. Like, I don't know why I'm so inspired by the movie Fern Gully, but there's something very magical about the saving the rainforest experience. And so I use different versions of it to create what I would see as a tribe that's not a tribe, that doesn't exist. It's not using any cultural references specifically from a tribe. And sort of make these different groups more about being positive with nature and fashion. And that's kind of like how I make my way around the other side of that.
Well, I think that that's actually a really interesting perspective, like that if you're educated as you are on different tribal cultures and whatever, then you sort of take elements of each of those and create something that incorporates so many different facets of it that none really directly reflect an existing group of people that could be offended. And then you sort of gear that towards people like, if you are of the mindset that we need to be more culturally accepting and erase homophobia. I mean, if you like sort of incorporate all these different concepts of like your idealistic human experience and then make clothing saying, like, if you believe this, then this is for you. You are this tribe. You are our Fern Gully tribe.
Yeah, I try to just use different cultures, you know, like Viking cult culture, Costa Rican rainforest tribe cult culture, and like it's all the stuff that's a little bit more untouched by media that I find more interesting. Like I did a whole collection, I think it was like right after school, but I built like shoes that are like 3 feet tall, and I grew real living moss and real trees and different forms of like living plants all around the bottom of the shoes, and then basically the shoes look like they were growing out of the ground. And then instead of using feathers, I use moss and leaves as, like, makeup. And, you know, it was kind of like the idea of how people would use a lot of feathers in a traditional stance. But instead, I used, like, live moss and different things like that and created a tribe of girls who were multiracial. And I did a whole piece about it, like, a long time ago in San Francisco. I did a performance art piece at the art gallery in Potrero Hill. There was just someone standing in it and just kind of, like, letting people experience it before I released my collection.
The way you describe it, it comes across as something that kind of like along the lines of like the Powerpuff Girls or whatever, like this collection of like semi-superheroes who each have something different that they stand for, and like Captain Planet. And then through the reflection of their fashion, they show what it is that's important to them. And then together they make this utopian culture.
Yeah, and the ones I did before were just women. I definitely wanted to do cultures run by women just because currently, well, at the time when I was doing it, it was, there was the beginning of that, it's not a beginning, but there was a new women's movement of people being upset that women weren't getting what they deserved and fair treatment. It's obviously still a battle. Everyone's still fighting their battles, but that was sort of my way in the time to just be like, these are these powerful women, they run their own culture, and so my whole experience and my whole, like, thing that I was trying to get everyone to get involved with was just the idea that, like, there can be cultures fully run by women. They're totally fine. Everything's great. They can do anything that anybody else can do. It's not really necessary that they need someone else unless they need someone else. And so that was my point in that collection. I definitely am trying to do more things with my community in San Francisco, and just with the community in general. I usually am, like, somewhere fighting for transgender rights because it just really speaks to me, and I have a lot of really, really close friends in the game and as models who are fighting to make their money and do their thing. So anytime I can do anything for charity, that sounds perfect to me.
Yeah, and I think that this is the thing that I love most about the experience of having done drag for so many years is that it has given me a sense of community that I never had before. It's made me part of the community in a way that I did not know that I could be. You know, like when I started doing drag back in 2006, the very first time I did it was for a charity event and a fundraising event. And then it's become so ingrained in me that, again, like going back to that idea I was talking about with your fashion about feeling a little bit like a superhero or whatever, as myself, like walking down the street as a gay guy in the community, I don't feel that I have the ability to influence people and inspire them to do things that are beneficial to the community quite the same way that Pollo Del Mar does. Like, quite the same way that I do if I put on a full face of makeup and, like, some ridiculous outfit and hair and step into the streets. I recognize that people respond to that in a different way. So, for me, the sense of community that's come with performing and being part of all of the things I've done for the past many years has been, like, probably the most rewarding element of it. And it's introduced me to so many cool people, and it makes a life, I think, very different when you feel connected to a cause, to the community, to the people. So I appreciate the fact that you are looking to continue expanding your kind of profile in that community and the work that we do.
Yeah, I definitely am. I've definitely in the past just picked out different parts and then just worked specifically on those because they spoke to me a lot at the time, you know, just because of a lot of the things like politically that were happening to, like, you know, just people coming out and people transitioning, and like that whole thing just really got me. So I spent a lot of time working with like transgender modeling agencies at my fashion week and my fashion shows to try to get the girls, to get these girls into my shows. And, you know, I never bring it up. It's never something that needs to be discussed in the moment. But if you look back at a majority of my work, it's got a pretty good blended cast of people that I feel like deserve to be seen.
Right. Well, and I think what you're mentioning is actually quite important. So often, of course, and there's a reason for it, because we need to bring visibility to it, especially in the media. But when hiring a transgender model, like, there's nothing, person does not walk down the runway with, like, a sign flashing behind them that says, like, this model is transgender. You know, it's what it's really about is that you're offering opportunities to people that they would not have gotten even a few years ago, perhaps, and allowing them the chance simply to do what they're passionate about and what they want to do in life, regardless of the circumstances that got them there.
Yeah, I mean, and these are really talented girls, and they are beautiful and amazing. It's just like some people, once they find out, if they find out, because, you know, most of the time you have no idea, but when they find out, it's just how they treat them and how they book them, and I just want to book girls for my shows, regardless of what their deal is. I want to have a 50-50 split of an opportunity for girls. So whatever girls show up are the girls that I want in my show. So it's a 50-50 split, and I generally try to make sure, you know, that they're there, the best ones, the ones that deserve to be there, not just because they're a thing or because I'm following some trend, but because, like, they worked hard, their work's amazing, they have a bomb-ass walk and a great body, you know?
I have a girl in mind that I want to introduce you to, by the way, Dexter. Like, the very first time I saw her, I was like, I think you need to be a runway model. I think that you need to be a supermodel. Gorgeous. I think that, you know, if you don't mind designing for a taller girl, she'd be perfect for you.
Well, it's not just me, but there's agencies for our girls now, you know? So Slay is one of the biggest ones. I work directly with them just because their girls are just, they're perfect. And so, if she's really, let's talk. We'll talk about that. I want to meet her. Because if she's right, then I'll send her over there and she can meet with them.
Wait, is that CeCe's?
CeCe, yeah.
Okay, yeah, we've had CeCe on the show before, and we're like, Pearl, who obviously is at work right now, and that's while we're talking, like, isn't here to speak with you, but we're longtime friends with CeCe, and we talked to him about the launch of Slay and all of the fun things that go into that. So,
oh, he's one of my favorite agencies to work with during Fashion Week. CeCe and I are on the phone giggling, and he sends me some of the most amazing girls, like in New York, in LA, wherever.
Yeah, I will definitely put you in touch. The girl I'm. Do you know Michaela, by chance? Hello? Are you there?
Wait, my cheekbones hit the mute, my bad.
Oh my god. Well, with cheekbones like that, honey, like, hitting the mute is the least of my concerns. Your cheekbones are so pronounced they could, like, actually accidentally... Don't make me cut you with my cheekbone. I will cut a bitch with this cheekbone.
Oh, man.
All right. Well, thank you for joining me, sweetheart. Do you have a website where people can go to find out more about your fashion?
Yeah, absolutely. My website is www.dextersimmons.com. That's S-I-M-M-O-N-S. Or you can find me on Instagram, and it'll link to it. And it's Dexter, S-L-A-W-K, Dexter Flock.
Okay. Sounds great. Thanks, sweetheart. I will talk to you soon.
Absolutely. Talk to you soon.
Bye. That is Dexter Simmons. And we will be back with more Party Foul Radio right after this.
Oh, she really came that way?
All right.
My name is Alyssa Edwards.
All right.
I need to
get up in this gig, girl.
My name is Alyssa Edwards, and this is Party Foul Radio.
I don't get cute. I get drop dead gorgeous.
And we're back with more Party Foul Radio. I am Poya Del Mar.
And I'm Pearl Teeth.
You guys, this is bringing us quickly to the close of episode 99.
All right, 99.
I got 99 problems, but a bitch ain't one. Right. Okay? Because Pearl's up in here with me, okay? The bitch is already provided.
Whatever.
Hey.
Anyway. Bay Area people, mark your calendars for January 25th for... Poyo's debut over at El Toro Nightclub.
It's not even my debut, girl. It's my return to El Toro Nightclub in the
but
wrestling
it's
ring.
It's like your actual debut of an actual match, right?
Well, we don't have me scheduled in a match, but okay. I will be heavily involved throughout that evening.
All right. Like it, I said.
It's going to... Who knows what's going to happen? Who knows what's going to happen? We do have great professional wrestling from the Bay Area on that show. Oh! Oh, my God. Totally unrelated... But it made me think about this. This is something I wanted to tell you about, Pearl.
Huh.
Okay, so on the podcast before, we've talked about how Pearl frequently, depending on the time of day, doesn't feel maybe, like, comfortable taking public transportation from my house home stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because she feels conspicuous. Well, I don't think she's conspicuous, but that's certainly her perception, and, like, you own that. Well... On Sunday, I had two events on Sunday, and one of them was in Aunt Charlie's Lounge for Renita Valdez and Colette LeGrand's birthday. So I went down there and hung out and performed and had a good kiki and good time. And then the other one was at the Port Bar in Oakland.
Mm-hmm.
I did not want to spend money on an Uber or a Lyft, so I took BART over in full fucking drag. Like,
all right.
Just done, head to toe. And I was like, I was nervous AF. I was like, I felt so conspicuous. And some people tried to pretend like they weren't seeing anything. Other girls and boys, I was done. Like, I was done. I was like, in full everything. I'm going to try to find the pictures to show Pearl. Because I took some pictures. I was like, I said, Carney, if I disappear, the last place I was seen is at the, Powell Street BART station.
That is grand.
So,
did anyone at least, like...
Some people stared. There was a lot of staring.
Okay.
One woman came and stared, and then, like, her child came and stared, and then some other person came and stared. But this is what I learned, y'all. I learned a damn valuable lesson.
Huh.
When somebody stares at you, stare back.
Yeah, that's what I do. I stare right back.
I stare back, and I stare hard. I told one of my friends, I was like, I will be damned... Like, because this is the thing, when somebody stares at you, whether they intend it to be, like, whether it's mentally, like, registering with them or not, part of that's an intimidation tactic. Because of the fact that they know it makes you uncomfortable and they don't give a fuck.
Right.
And so I looked up, and this kid, like, this probably, like, maybe an 18, 19-year-old guy was staring at me. And then he saw me looking at him, like, he saw me catching him staring, and then... He, like, looked away, but then he looked right back.
And you were still looking?
Bitch, I was burning a hole in him. I just went, raised my eyebrow, just stared at him, didn't take my eyes off of him. Girl, he felt so uncomfortable. Eventually, he just, like, turned and walked away. And I was like, I will be damned. For, you know, the one thing that I was talking... You know Carla Gay, right?
I know Carla Gay.
So Carla Gay is a local transgender woman... She's quite a bit older than either of us. She's probably like in her 50s, maybe even 60s.
Right.
She's been around for a very, very long time. And I was talking to her right before I left. And I was like, girl, I'm a little nervous about this. And she goes, oh, mama, you'll be fine. They're just going to stare how pretty you are. And I told her, I was like, the one thing that I will note about this situation that is different than the other women, like the trans women in my life that I know, is that this is how I'm presenting, but this is not who I am.
Right.
You know what I mean? This is not my identity. Like, I can go to the bathroom and wash this off, and it's done. But so I said, if somebody were to fuck with me, if somebody would have taken it beyond the staring, they would have learned really, really quickly that underneath the makeup and that weave that I was wearing...
is a man.
A dude.
Right.
Straight up a man. And, bitch, I've got weapons on my feet. I would have reached it down... taking off one of those 7-inch platforms that I had on and just beat the fuck out of somebody if I had to. But the thing that I was thinking about as I was passing, you know, because in San Francisco, I wasn't so nervous about it. People will stare or whatever.
Right.
Girl, hit West Oakland. All of a sudden, I was like, oh, because you don't know what the fuck is going to get through those doors when the doors open. You don't know who's coming on. And I was like, okay, so this is what... like Pearl is talking about and other people feel like this anxiety because I was like on guard. Like I couldn't like pay attention to my phone or whatever. Cause I had to be like sort of poised and ready. And I was thinking about that on the way over there. I was like, yeah, this is something that very different for me because I told you about the time that this dude came up when I was eating at Orphan Andy's with Kenya Michaels from RuPaul's Drag Race, y'all. She's tiny. She's trans now. She was transitioning then. She's, like, done now. Like, it's over. Like, the transition has happened. And she's woman for days, bitch. She's I'm serving you cha-cha for days, bitch. So, anyway, she and I were eating, and we were both in drag. And this dude was, like, not able to get seated. And he comes over and reached across her table into Kenya's plate and grabbed a handful of fries and goes, I know little Kim will give me some fries.
Oh, my God.
I was furious, but the thing about it was, I think Ms. Palou is with us, too.
Uh-huh.
When I stood up, I was like, you've got to be fucking kidding me. And I stood up and slammed my hands on the table. And when I stood up, I'm, like, almost 7 foot tall. Like, I was in the heels and the hair and everything. Mm-hmm. That dude who reached into her plate probably shit himself on the spot. I literally saw, he, like, his eyes open. He was like, ah! he ran out. I was like, oh no, motherfucker. I went into the street chasing him. I was like, nobody fucks with my friends.
Right.
So and it would have been, I was ready for all of that. I was like, I was summoning my inner, like my inner China, my inner wrestler. Right. I was like, I'm going to have, if I have to beat some ass up at the Oakland BART station, I'm going to do it.
Right.
So as it turned out, nothing like that happened.
It's just uncomfortable.
It is uncomfortable. And it does register that in your head. Like, right. What could I be facing?
Right.
What, you know, having to constantly feel, like, on guard.
Yeah, on guard, annoyed, frustrated. Just all these uncomfortable, unwanted emotions that you just have to sit there and deal with.
Mm-hmm.
Until you get to where you're going, hopefully safely.
Yeah, and, you know, as it turned out, I went right to 19th Street BART station and got off, and, I was all done up. Like, one person gave me the side eye, and I was, like, I had to bite my tongue, because literally the first thing that, like, was right there waiting to come out was, like, bet you never thought you were going to see Beyonce at the BART station, did you?
Oh, my God. Girl, I would have death dropped.
I was like, no. Oh, like,
my God.
All my braids and all my glamour. Right. I was like, oh, bet you never thought you were going to see that, did you?
Shit. That would have been fucking hilarious.
It just gave me a new respect for the experiences of others because,
yeah,
you know, I'm already flamboyantly gay, like, in my regular daily life, right, for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
I think when people see the way I dress, dude today saw the way I was dressed. I was at some store, like, in the hood over on Mission Street, mm-hmm, and he said, you're giving me flashback to Run DMC.
Yeah. Pollo dresses like a little kid, you guys.
Well, there's that. And, like, I dress kind of urban. I dress, like...
She dresses like a little kid with a lot of colors.
And I dress like... But no, I dress like a...
coordination, girl.
I definitely dress like a guy, though.
Mm-hmm.
And even though there's elements of me that are, like, certainly... I never try to tone myself down. Like, what you see is what you get.
Yeah.
But most people don't... You know, I can be sitting on the bus. I'm pretty sure sitting on the bus listening to music and not doing anything... And I probably don't set off a lot of radars for people, right, in any way. And then I'm, like, the phone call comes in or something, and I'm like, hey, girl! And everybody's like, what the fuck happened?
Right.
But but it's something that I don't think about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And in certain situations and environments, I have had to think about it, and it's very uncomfortable. But in this situation, I was like, it was just a real reminder to me of why... Not only do, like, our trans brothers and sisters have an experience that they do, but why we really need to keep moving our community forward.
Right.
So that, ideally, unfortunately, these things will never be fully eliminated. It's human nature to stare at people.
Right.
It's human nature to fucking get up in people's business. It's, like, it's part of the human experience. But...
Oh, and it can be rough sometimes, girl. Girl, even recently, like, I've dealt with it. Like, me and my partner went... And had lunch one day because I had a day off or something. I don't remember what the occasion was, but we went to go have lunch, and there was a little girl. She was probably like 5-6 years old, who would stare, and I would stare back, and she would just continue staring. I was like, oh my God, this is just so uncomfortable. So I switched seats with my partner, so my back was at her, but that did not stop her. And it's obviously that's a little kid, so I was, like, in no danger. But it's still, like, girl, leave me alone. I'm trying to eat.
Well, that's when you say to them, your mother needs to give you some fucking manners.
Right. Then I have to deal with her mom.
I would have surely had to tell her mom, you need to teach your child some fucking manners.
Right.
Like, right. I mean, see, that's also the difference between me and other people, y'all. I really have no problem being like, what the fuck is your problem?
Yeah, but I don't want to be the black girl in the restaurant right now.
I know. That, like, that's the other part of it.
Yeah.
Like, by the way, speaking of which, I don't know what that triggered, but do you know K. Michelle? You know K. Michelle.
Yeah, I know K. Michelle.
Okay, so K. Michelle, hip-hop R&B singer, got a new album out. And one of the songs on the album is called Kim K.
It's like Kim Kardashian?
Like Kim Kardashian. And off the whole album, I think that song is the one that could be the biggest hit if they pushed it. But what made me think about it is the fact in the song, she says, I wish I was a Kardashian so I could be black.
Oh, my God.
And
yeah.
Listeners, the Kardashians are not black.
Right.
But But what she means by it and the way she talks about it is that, like, as a black woman, she's not allowed to have, like, to speak her mind because then she's angry and she's this or that. And it's like, you know, like, there's all of these things that she can't, she doesn't feel like society will allow her to just be because she's a black woman. And there's some judgment placed on that. But then some bitch like the Kardashians turns around and does exactly the same thing.
And they're kind of praised for it.
And they're like, oh, look at her. I mean, I definitely think that some of the things that society looks like that probably are like stereotyped as black things aren't really necessarily black things.
Things to begin
like
with,
being
yeah.
loud and being obnoxious and being rude and all those things.
That's not a black
thing. That's not a black thing. That's a rude thing.
Right.
But I think that I definitely think it gets associated with race sometimes, especially when you see like a black person doing that. They're not, they have to be like on their best behavior. I think that's what she's saying.
Right.
But girl, you should check it out. That song is
I'm totally going to.
It, like, and it's also like it also speaks to something. So her publicist, Kay Michelle's publicist, Martha Tang, has brought many guests onto our show in the past. She's a longtime homegirl of mine, and she sent me some stuff from the new Kay Michelle album. She's like, "What do you think of this?" And I said, "The song Kim K is the hit." And she's like, "It sounds so angry, don't you think?" And I was like,
"Oh,
I was like, well, yeah, but it's social commentary." And she's like, "Well, she's just." I'm afraid that people will think she's, like, just bitchy. And I was like, she's giving you social commentary. She's saying that she is, in fact, a black woman who is not allowed to do
or
be parts of her personality because they're painted so negatively. But people like the Kardashians get away with it. Something else that she also says is that you don't want to see me with a rapper. Like, you don't want to see a rapper with a woman like me. You'd rather see him with Kim K. You'd rather see him with, like, some white woman.
Right.
Like, than another black woman who's, like, getting her own.
Yeah.
And it's an interesting thing. And I said, my thought, my assumption is because I think that there's this idea that, you know, if a black man is with some white woman, then you can collectively dislike white people or the white woman for, like, stealing. But if there's a black woman who's, like, with a successful male or a black man... then what can you say? Bitch, the problem is not that he doesn't like black women. It's something about you. He don't like you for some reason.
Right.
Like, so it becomes, it's like this whole thing. But anyway, and the song is banging on top of it. So.
Wow. I'm totally going to check that out. Yeah, I'm totally checking that out.
There's some good stuff on there. There's also a song called Fuck Your Man.
Of course.
On there. The one thing I will say about Kay Michelle, I've tried to get her on the show before.
Yeah, we should.
We got real, real close, and then I was waiting for her phone call, and they never called, and then her publicist was like, I'm sorry, something came up, and I think she was in the middle of a lawsuit with somebody,
because
she was in all these feuds. This was a feud, like, her last album, and then she was in all these, like, feuds with people, and I think that basically they just wanted to keep her mouth shut, probably let shit cool down is what they think that they wanted. But anyway, the one thing I will say about her is that sometimes I get frustrated by her, because I don't feel like she really... has an identity as a musician.
As an artist, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's sometimes, like, if you listen to her whole album, you'll be like, this sounds like a Rihanna song, and this sounds like a so-and-so song, and this sounds like a somebody else's song. And it's like, so, who are you?
Right.
Like, you know.
What makes you different?
What makes you, you?
Yeah.
But that Kim K song is, like, is the bomb. And there's a song on the album that does sound like Rihanna, and then there's, like, this jazzy song called Fuck Your Man or whatever. But the other thing about her, and this is something that's so weird to say, but there are certain women who, like, they want to act all sexy, and when they do, it just comes across really awkward. It does not come across sexy the way they move or whatever.
Yeah.
She's one of them.
There's a lot of people in general that do that, though.
Yeah, but
I'm not even going to go there, girl, but yeah.
But she's definitely one of the women that... Like, in her music videos, there'll be times when you're like, you know she's trying to be sexy, and she just looks awkward as fuck right now.
Right.
It makes me uncomfortable to watch.
I mean,
but
imagine some of these queens when they perform, girl. I'm not even gonna...
Oh.
I've seen some pretty awkward numbers.
Well, yes. I saw one where this girl was at a show a while back, and Simone Gemini was also on the show.
Uh-huh.
And Simone Gemini is a former Miss Gay United States.
But she is like a siren girl.
She's was on Transcendent. Mm-hmm. And yes, and the thing about, she is a siren. Like, she literally, every time she moves, it's just sex. Like, everything about her is just sex. Mm-hmm. And she's one of the few people I've ever seen do, like, Sade, perform Sade, and I'm, like, hanging on every move because everything is so sexual. So she does her thing. She's on stage, and she's, like, just fucking gagging everybody with her sexiness and whatever. And then there was another girl who was, like, much, much newer or whatever, and she, I think that what happened, this is me just guessing, trying to make excuses for a really awkward number. She must have been watching and thinking, ooh, I'm going to do that, too. I'm going to go up there. I'm going to be sexy like that, too. And... So, this is when I was still at the cafe, and she, like, puts her leg up on the, like, on the railing, like, she's gonna be all sexy and whatever, and basically, it just looked like she was scratching her cooch, like, you know, like, you see an animal sort of, like, rub its back or whatever, it was not sexy. I was like, oh, girl, no, bitch, now I'm gonna have to disinfect the railing. No, ma'am.
Shit.
Poor thing. Anyway, all right, you guys, we have blabbed on and on for almost 2 damn hours. This is episode 99 of Party Foul Radio. That means the next time you join us, Pearl will be getting her triple digits.
Yes, come on, 100.
We will be back next week with more of this and that and us and you and all the things good about this show. Until next week, I'm Poyet Almar.
And I'm... Whoa, girl. And I'm Pearl Teeth.
You're listening to Party Foul Radio, and we'll see you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
It's over. Work, it's over. Work, it's over. She's the one. Girl, you better.